Holy crap.
People persist in doubting the evidence.
Don't run and hide. Don't be afraid. Don't turn away any longer. The truth will set you free.
You're listening to Jimmy Church, Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network.
We're turning all of our antennas towards Jimmy Church on Dark Matter Radio.
And now, your host, the captain of conspiracy, the prince of paranormal. This ain't your daddy's radio network show. This is Jimmy Church, Fade to Black.
Hey, Monday. How you doing? How you doing? Check out Michael Anderson. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. After the show tonight, he's got his bedtime story right there in his hand. Welcome, everybody. This is Fade to Black, bespoke radio for the masses. Very wonderful Monday to you. It is December 8th, 341 days into the new year. 24 days left. Wow. We are live. Live from the truthfunders.com studios right here in Burbank, California. How does that sound? New sponsor for the studios, truthfunders.com. Got a lot to talk about, Truth Funders, over the next couple of weeks. Welcome them. The banner's right over there. We got the brand new website went live this weekend. We'll talk about that. For KJCR and the Dark Matter Radio Network, I am your oh-so-humble host, Jimmy Church. I love my Mondays. Welcome to everybody. Tonight, Joseph, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell will be with us for the duration. Very excited about this show tonight. Been working with the good doctor for the last year. And we've got him. It's going to be a great night. Big salute to the proud men and women in uniform all around the world fighting the good fight for us. This is the holidays. December, you're out there doing what you do for this country of ours. And it can get a little lonely out there. So think about that for a second. Our right to freedom of speech is protected and guaranteed. Podcast is flying. Let's get that out of the way. If you go over to the website is blazing fast. Rick Sinnott wrote me an email. He said, dude, I got whiplash. That site is fast. Thank you, Method, so much. I just tweeted before the show. He deserves a medal for all the work that he has put into that site. That site is absolutely amazing. Thank you so much. It is so fast. We're so used to the old site. And now it's just blip, 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 blip. It is blazing lightning quick. It is all that. Faders.org, too, as well. I wanted a site that would compare to faders.org. And I knew that we couldn't quite get there, but we're close. The site is wonderful. So thank you so much. And what was I just saying? Oh, so the podcast links. What I want everybody to do, if you're listening to my voice right now, is please, during the show tonight, tomorrow, overnight, go over to jimmychurchradio.com, go to the new site, check it out, click on everything and try to break it. If you find something that isn't working, it's such a complex site. So if there's something that's not quite, let us know. And we'll get it fixed. We were fixing stuff right up until showtime tonight. Okay, so, but please go check it out. Enjoy it. Somebody tweeted, I swear to God, I'm not making this up. There's not one picture of Jimmy on the site. Thank goodness for that. Yeah. It's not about me. It's about you. I want to make sure that everybody thinks this site is perfect. that this is exactly what you need. This is what you want. All right? And then I'm comfortable. Okay? It's all about you. Never forget that. And with that, it is Monday. Yes, Dan, we know about that, and that is being worked on right now. The logo works. The button doesn't work. We'll get it. Okay? We're close. That's on the list. It'll probably be fixed here in the next few minutes. We're working on stuff right now in real time on the site. And again, anything that that you don't, just put it in an email, tweet it to us, tweet it to Method. Do what you got to do and let us know. All right? Today, let's get this show cracking. I am so fired up when it comes to Mondays. And we, you know, we worked all weekend on the website, as you guys know. And, oh, I left my phone on. Can somebody, where is it? There it is. You just heard that. That's a Harley. That's my text message is a Harley starting up. Okay, let's get that turned off. There you go. We worked all weekend on the website. And there was some other stuff that was going on, too. And it was just such an exciting, fun weekend. I couldn't wait to get to today. Couldn't. And now we are here. So just know I am jacked. And tonight it's not the coffee talking. It's not. Let's get this show cracking. Today, Def Leppard guitarist Phil Collins is 57. Who saw the post that I did over the weekend about somebody over at overseas in the UK for the Telegraph wrote an article, the 20 greatest metal albums of all time, heavy metal albums. And I popped that open and I couldn't wait to see it. And I was like, wait a minute. There's 20 albums on this list and I don't agree with one of them. How is that possible? So I popped it out, popped out my top 10. I just went 10. I didn't go 20. I should have gone 20. I went 10. But the reaction from all of you was the same thing. These aren't heavy metal bands. There isn't any heavy metal on there. I think one, maybe Iron Maiden. Oh, Black Sabbath was on there too. But anyway, I digress. Def Leppard guitarist Phil Collins is 57 years old. Guitarist Marty Friedman. Remember Marty, don't you? The Yngwie guy? 52 years old, and friend of mine today, I had to get this in there, big shout out to Athena Kotak, otherwise known as Athena Lee Kotak, that's right, Tommy Lee's little sister, she's a drummer and a good one, she's 50 years old, I've known her for, man, 25, 30 years I've known her, and I worked with her in her band called Hardly Dangerous. And, yeah, she's the sister of Tommy Lee. Learn how to play from Tommy. And she's 50 years old. Also, I want to give a shout-out to Tommy Ray out there in Las Vegas, James Brown's wife, the James Brown, who left us not too long ago. But Tommy was the singer in Hardly Dangerous. And I've known those girls since we were kids. So there you go. Big shout-out to Tommy Ray. Singer Greg Allman today is 67 years old. And this is what's weird. That's why I love doing this show. Love my little birthday section. Our dead guys' birthdays today, and this happens rarely, there are four significant birthdays today. Are you ready? David Carradine, born in 1936, died in 2009. Kung Fu, David Carradine. Sammy Davis Jr. was born today. It's his birthday. Born in 1925, died in 1990. Jim Morrison, 1943, died in 1971. And here we go. The big one. Comedian Sam Kennison, who I worked for quite a while and was very close to Sam. Born in 1953, died in 1992, and that day broke my heart. Sam Kennison, truly singular genius, born today. Happy birthday, Sam, if you are listening, my brother. All right. Now, let's fire up Twitter. Let's get this cracking. Let's go right now. I got to know right now. Let's show that guy from the Telegraph over in London. Is Def Leppard really a metal band? Now, they're great, but should they be on a heavy metal list? Def Leppard? Really? Oh, I can't forget. Happy birthday to Ken Libsyn. I tweeted that out and got that out all day today. Happy birthday, Ken. Miss you, brother. I need some artwork done. Ken Libsyn, happy birthday. All right. Twitter, is Def Leppard a heavy metal band? How is that possible? Okay, please. Somebody. I want to see somebody have the stones to disagree with me. I want somebody to argue back. Yeah, man, they're metal. Hysteria was a metal album, dude. Nah. Tonight we have Joseph P. Farrell. Tomorrow night, Robert Morningstar. And on Wednesday, Laird Scranton will be with us. We've got a great week lined up. Firing it off tonight with Joseph Farrell. Very excited about this. Going to be great. Open lines. I really want Joseph, if we have the time, I want to open up the lines tonight. If we do, 323-825-5045. You can email throughout the show, as always, jimmy@jimmychurchradio.com. Look at everybody. Even Jeff Krause says they're not metal. And if Jeff Krause says they're not metal, then my goodness, that's it. That's the law right there. Jeff Krause. How you doing, Jeff? All right. Jimmy@jimmychurchradio.com. Because we shifted all of our servers over the weekend, got a couple little hiccups that are still being ironed out with Jimmy@jimmychurchradio.com, but I think as of noon today, all of that was straightened out. So email should be live and active tonight. All right, and I'll get to that and check it during the break. Tweet deck, hashtag F2BQ. That's what you want to do. Okay, you got a question? You guys have sound? I hear nothing. That's from Stephen G., and that just came in 6 minutes ago. Everybody else says everything is fine. So, Stephen, I don't know what that is about. But he just tweeted, hashtag F2BQ. That's hashtag Fade to Black Questions. F and the number 2, BQ. Fade to Black Questions. You got something you want to get directly to me? Shoot it there. I'll get it. I'll read it. If it's for Joseph, bang it there. You can also do it through email. All right? I believe that everything over at jimmychurchradio.com is up and running as far as the contacts page goes. So, it's not a bad idea. Anybody wants to run over there and do a dry run into the producers? Let's make sure that that is all running correctly, too. Website's brand new. We've been working on it for 2 months, I think. And it's just so complex. We have a list of little teeny tiny things that have to get fixed. Okay, but I do. I want you guys to try to break it. Let's see if we can do that. Okay? All right. Man, I'm jacked up. It is Monday. Quick email. All right. Yeah, I've got enough time to get this in. This is from Renee. I had to get to this. Where were you when John Lennon died? On Monday night, December 8th, 1980, I was living in West Los Angeles, driving home around 9:30 p.m. from an evening out with friends. That's what you do in West Hollywood, especially in 1980. Young lady, Renee, what were you doing? What was the nightclub? A news bulletin on my car radio interrupted rock music with only 90 minutes after he died in New York. I was so shocked, I almost lost control of the car. I remember thinking, I'm lucky it's on a side street, and I'm not on the freeway. I pulled over, gasping for air with a horrible sinking feeling as if all the blood were draining from my head. And I just sat in the car, listening to the DJ tell me that my hero, John Lennon, had just been assassinated. I felt numb listening to him say twice the little bit of news he had at the time and managed to drive the few remaining blocks home. And I remember exactly where I was when that happened. I had walked into my bedroom and I had turned on my little ghetto blaster on the shelf in my bedroom. I was a senior in high school at the time. I turned it on and heard the same thing. And I couldn't believe it. And the what made it worse with John Lennon is because a month and a week before that, John Bonham had died. And I did the same thing with Bonham. I had walked into my bedroom, flicked on my ghetto blaster to WFBQ 95, Indy, and I get the John Bonham message. And it crushed me. And then a month later, Lennon, same place, same way, in my bedroom alone. And I had to just sit there and take it in. So, yes, today, John Lennon was killed. So, there you go. All right, I had to get that off my chest because I thought about that when I read Renee's email. And I'm thinking, that's right. I was exactly in the same spot. And I remember thinking to myself when I got the John Lennon, I was just like, it just happened with Bonham. I hate going to my bedroom. I hate turning on my ghetto blaster. This sucks. But you know what? The show must go on, folks. This is Fade to Black. It is Monday tonight. Joseph P. Farrell. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Follow us on Twitter at JChurchRadio. Shoot me an email, jimmy@jimmychurchradio.com. This is Bespoke Radio for the Masses, only on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Do not touch that mouse. I'm jacked. It's going to be a great show tonight. Stay with us, everybody.
You're listening to Jimmy Church, Fade to Black, on the Dark Matter Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys, you have tuned into the latest phenomenon in late-night talk radio, Fade to Black, starring the inimitable Jimmy Church, showcasing his continuing quest in pursuit of knowledge of the strange and paranormal. Sit back, open your mind, and let's get cracking.
What's up, revolutionaries? It's me, Jimmy Church. Do you have an IRS or state tax issue? Well, I did, and I called national tax experts. My problems were fixed, done, finis, and man, I gotta tell you, it was a relief. National Tax Experts are a recognized tax office that services clients in all 50 states. Doesn't matter where you live. Give them a call. I'm telling you, they take the time to understand each and every client's individual financial status as well as their financial goals. And that's exactly what you need, my brother, when you're taking on the evil three-letter. So, seriously. Give them a call today at 1-877-909-5444. Again, 1-877-909-5444. Or go check out their website, www.nattaxexperts.com. That's NATTAXEXPERTS.com. Tell them Jimmy sent you.
This is KJCR at JimmyChurchRadio.com.
On the Dark Matter.
Bill Wellplay just tweeted, Hysteria, awesome heavy metal album, one of the best all time. Wow. Hey, one of the best albums of all time, no doubt. Heavy metal? Really? I don't know. Love Def Leppard. Love Def Leppard. Loves me some Leppard. This is Fade to Black, only on the Dark Matter Radio Network, Bespoke Radio for the Masses. Let's get this show cracking. Follow us on Twitter right now, at JChurchRadio. Hashtag DM Radio Net. Come hang out in the sandbox. It's going to be a great night tonight. Joseph P. Farrell will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. Right now, let's get to some headlines that you just may not know anything about. Nick Pope, our good friend, Nick Pope on UFO Digest about a month ago wrote an article. You can go check it out. It's called UFOs, A Smoking Gun at Last. Now, I talked to John Burroughs today for about 2 hours on the phone. I'm sure John is listening right now. And I talked to him today for a couple hours, and we talked about this article, and I went back and reread it. And he's right. And Nick is right. There's something curious that Project Condyne over in the UK, with their final report, wrote back in May 2006. And Nick Pope says, he says, bear in mind that unlike other the various MJ-12 documents, the provenance of this report isn't disputed. You can even read it on the UK government's own website. But listen to this quote, and this is directly from the report. Listen to this. This is about Rendlesham. And I'm reading direct. Quote, the well-reported Rendlesham Forest Bentwaters event is an example where it might be postulated that several observers were probably exposed to UAP radiation for longer than normal UAP sighting periods. End quote. What is UAP? UAP is unidentified aerial phenomena. That's what the UK government calls UFOs, UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. Now that you know what UAP means, let me read this quote again. Quote, the well-reported Rendlesham Forest Bentwaters event is an example where it might be postulated that several observers were probably exposed to UAP radiation for longer than normal UAP sighting periods, end quote. That, my friends, is about as close as you're going to get to a smoking gun. It's one step short of an ET craft being found in a warehouse somewhere. That is frightening. More on this as it develops. Two nights ago, at about 1 a.m., at the intersection of 57 and East Madison Avenue in Manhattan, a populated area of about four blocks from Columbus Circle, the NYPD used a long-range acoustic device. It's called an LRAD, to disperse about 100 protesters that were in the streets. Footage captured by YouTube user James C. shows the weapon in use beginning at the 158 mark. Protesters scattered in response to the sound, and either a live officer over a PA system or an automated voice intermittently told protesters between the sound blast that they could not interfere with vehicular traffic without risking arrest. The LRAD is deployed multiple times throughout the 5-minute video clip. No coverage of the LRAD was reported in any mainstream media. Early in the night, at about 11 p.m., CNN correspondent Brooke Baldwin praised the behavior of the protesters and the NYPD's response to the protests, remarking live on television, this is exactly how it's supposed to be, end quote. Yep. And is this using some kind of technology like this, acoustic beams at protesters? Is it cool? Is it better than rubber bullets? Is it better than tear gas? I know this much. It scares the crap out of me. On Friday, December 5th, that's right, NASA launched Orion, the multi-purpose crew vehicle, and made it back. Made two looping orbits around the planet, splashed down out here, Baja California in the Pacific Ocean, completing what looks like a nearly flawless mission. I watched the video of the launch, and I got to say, It just looks archaic. I'm not sure if we're making... something feels weird. I don't know if we're taking a step forward or a step back. To me, I just want the space shuttle, man. Bring it back. What was so wrong with that? I mean, that was so cool. We were the only one where anybody can fire up a rocket. Anybody can do that. And it's just, what country hasn't? Everybody's shooting men to the moon right now. Who cares? I mean, please. Everybody's got a rocket program. I want my space shuttle back. Dang it. Today, Ralph Baer, the inventor of the first home video game console, died. He's 92 years old. His family confirmed his death at his home in Manchester, New Hampshire, to the New York Times. Baer was an engineer with a defense contractor in 1966 when he just started looking at TVs and thinking, I want to play games on television. He's from Germany, Jewish, moved to the United States before World War II, patented several video game prototypes. And as we all know now, anybody that's into video games, I'm getting to that, Elias. I'm getting to that. It was called the Brown Box. And it would go on to become the Magnavox Odyssey. Now, I got to say, that was the first commercially available home gaming video system. My family had one. We all did. And we sat there and played Pong. I think they called it tennis. Pong, same thing as Atari's Pong, which came out later. But we played that thing all day and all night, didn't we? That's right. Ralph Baer. Wow. Went on to a better place. But you know what? There are few game changers in the world. Ralph Baer was one of them. You ready for this? In 2006, that was the year Twitter debuted, and Pluto was demoted to dwarf planet status. It was also the last time that you ate French Toast Crunch cereal here in the United States. That's right. But guess what? French Toast Crunch is back. Yeah, it's back. I'm not kidding. We're going to get French Toast Crunch back in the stores. It is a good a good month. You remember Quisp and Quake? You remember Quisp made its little comeback? I want Quisp again. And man, that's another Twitter question. What's the bomb cereal? I've got a few. Captain Crunch, Peanut Butter Crunch. Yeah, right? Lucky Charms, yeah. Yep. But I like my French Toast Crunch. Miss it. Cinnamon Toast Crunch is right there, though. That's like top three. That's top three. Could be top four. Transport authorities in New Delhi have cracked down on Uber after a woman accused one of its drivers of rape. That's right. Now, they are banned in New Delhi indefinitely. Uber's a freaky thing. Yeah, Crunch Berries. I'm with you, Bob. I'm with you. Cheerios still rules. Yep. French Toast Crunch on ice cream? Letty Trumbauer. I got to go there. Uber just doesn't feel right to me. And I had a production company a couple of months ago send me some cars to drive me to do some filming and on location. And it was Uber. And I got to tell you, man, I was a little uncomfortable with what was going on. You know, I'm not saying I want a stretch limousine. I'm just saying I want a guy that looks like he's had his license for a little bit, that there's some background. It just felt a little weird. Putting your life in somebody's hands that, you know, anybody, it seems. I don't know. I'm not a taxi driver. I'm not an Uber driver. I'm not an any driver. But can anybody just go and drive for Uber? You know what I mean? Felon? I don't know. It just feels weird. Uber doesn't feel quite right. $18 billion company already? It's just something just feels a little dirty. This is Fade to Black. You guys ready? Are you guys ready? I am. I love Mondays. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Fade to Black, bespoke radio for the masses. Let's get this show cracking. Let's get this out of the way. When I come back, Joseph P. Farrell will be joining us right here. We are only on the Dark Matter Radio Network. I'll be back right after this. Stay with us.
Are you afraid of the dark? Don't move. Don't touch that mouse. You are listening to Fade to Black, bespoke radio for the masses, on jimmychurchradio.com.
Way out here, we listen to Jimmy Church on the Dark Matter Radio Network.
Dark Matter.
Dark Matter. Dark Matter. Dark Matter. Dark Matter.
You're listening to Fade to Black
on the Dark Matter Radio Network.
¿Qué tal, mis amigos? Yo soy Mario Carson, el tiburón, y los invito para que escuchen a mi buen amigo Jimmy Church Radio. ¡Claro que sí!
Oi, oi, I'm Reese Evans. You're listening to Jimmy Church. This is Revolution. The Revolution will not be televised. The Revolution is on radio. Ciao.
All right, welcome back. Fade to Black, bespoke radio for the masses. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We are only on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Shoot me an email right now, jimmy@jimmychurchradio.com. You can follow us over on Twitter, @JChurchRadio, #DMRadioNet. Come hang out in the sandbox. As you know, every night we'll blast through 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 tweets. And so come hang out with us. It's a nice, friendly bunch over here. I am ready. Joseph Farrell is in the batter's box, so let's get this cracking, all right? Joseph P. Farrell has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford and pursues research in physics, alternative history, and science and strange stuff. He is the author of the following books in the field of alternative research: The Giza Death Star, one of my favorites, The Giza Death Star Deployed, one of my second favorites, The Reich of the Black Sun, The Giza Death Star Destroyed, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, The Cosmic War, Secrets of the Unified Field, The Philosopher's Stone, The Nazi International, Babylon's Banksters, and Roswell and the Reich. He is currently researching and writing, and I can verify this, two more books, plus jointly writing another book with Dr. DeHart. I would like to welcome to the program Joseph P. Farrell. Joseph, are you with us, sir?
Sure am. Thanks for having me on, Jimmy.
Yeah, and I'm going to say this right now, not to throw you under the bus, just to verify. We have tried, as you know, you and I have talked all year about coming on the show, and you are just the research king. You are always working, and a little frustrating for me on my end, but, you know, you're one of those guys that really gets it done. And but I'm just letting everybody know, when I say you're researching, you have been researching.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. I promise I won't be so difficult to get a hold of in the future.
I'm just like, man, I know, you know, his stuff is the best, and I don't want to take away from that. And it's kind of a selfish thing for me, because I just want to get you on and enjoy a conversation. But I know that you're working really hard, and you know, what are the next two books that you're working on, actually? What are you doing right now?
Well, I normally don't go into specifics on books. I'm working on another book with Dr. Scott DeHart, and then I'm working on a book for myself that's going to be a sequel kind of to some of the banking Nazi things kind of combined there.
Okay. You know, as you know, this conversation is going to go all over the place tonight, but I have to ask this question. You go into some dangerous ground, some dangerous subject matter. Are you ever scared? Are you ever a little worried?
I don't get scared. I don't worry. You know, God's going to take me when he's ready to take me.
Right.
So I'm not going to worry about it. I have had some kind of bizarre things happen, but I mean, it's nothing that gives me any concern. No.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, one of the reasons for that probably is because you speak the truth. You know, and that's it. If it was something else, but you know, you're not going to be silenced. And if it's straightforward and well researched stuff, then doing something would send all the wrong signals. It would show the world that, man, you are spot on the money.
Yeah, that may be. And the other reason they may not have done anything is I may be all wrong too. So
or armed. So. Okay, well, you know what, let's back up a step, because patristics and a doctorate in that area for what your research is today, pretty strange little left or right hand turn that you took. Was it an epiphany? Can you take us back to that time through college and then what happened?
Well, it's really not all that strange. I've been interested in history all of my life. Particularly World War II, and patristics sounds like it's a rather narrow degree, but in point of fact, if you study patristics, you have to study, you know, classical and medieval philosophy, you have to study several languages, you have to study a bit about the history of science, law, so, you know, it's actually a much broader degree than it initially sounds like. And for the purposes of what I do, I do a lot of examination of documents and ancient texts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, dealing with patristics, you're dealing with texts all the time, and it actually facilitates, in a certain sense, it facilitates the kind of research I do now. So I don't think of it as all that huge of a change for me.
Were you ever considering something theological or a religious career? Did that ever come?
Yeah, I did at one time. In fact, I was for a couple of years. I was an assistant professor of theological subjects at an Eastern Orthodox seminary in Pennsylvania. So I did do that for a while.
So then what happened?
well, let's without going into nitty gritty gruesome details. It's really not a subject I talk about too much, but. It was just a very unpleasant experience. I left voluntarily, and the clergy involved that did certain things that I didn't terribly care for back then are 10 years later down the line, they're in kind of an ecclesiastical hot box themselves. So.
Sure.
You know, karma will out.
and absolutely. And so with all of that education, that must be a really, man, I don't want to say bullet in your gun, but it is certainly a wealth of knowledge going into your research with, you know, ancient religions and mystic schools and some of the other stuff that you work. It must have been invaluable to have.
Oh yeah, it has proven, especially when I deal with things like Hermetic philosophy or mystery schools or occult texts or alchemical texts, things like that. It's been quite invaluable for that.
And what about looking back forward? Does modern religion make a lot of sense because of the research that you've done back into the mystic school? So it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it cuts both ways. I tend to be kind of traditional in my religious outlook still to this day, even though I'm not affiliated with any particular religious body. most modern religion seems to me kind of wackadoodle. So, for want of a better expression,
there went Twitter. Okay,
there went Twitter.
Yep. But no, you're absolutely right. And myself, people always want to know, you know, what my background is when it comes to that. I leave it. I let it go because I'm still a little unclear for myself too as well. I don't have all the answers. I'm just right. Like everybody else. I'm always looking for the miracle. You know, I'm always looking for something to just bust me wide open and go, okay, aha, now I get it. Well, it hasn't happened for me yet. And in the past when I was almost there, then something else pops up and makes me scratch my head and back up again, just like you were referring to back right. when you were in school. So yeah, I think it's just as wacky today as it probably was 2,000 years ago.
Yep.
With Herod and Jerusalem, you know. Yep. So. All right. So now, you leave Oxford and you come back here and you started teaching, right?
Right.
That
right.
was your next step. And what was it Oklahoma? Where? What?
I did some college teaching as an adjunct professor at the University Center at Tulsa,
right.
Both for Langston University and then subsequently for the University of Oklahoma. I taught a variety of subjects. I taught medieval history, modern European history, diplomatic history, medieval philosophy, classical philosophy. I did a couple of honors seminars in philosophy. I did Russian history and British history, and one semester I had to substitute for another professor that couldn't teach his normal class, and I did a course in diplomatic history of the United States. So it was fun, but you know, being an adjunct, which is how they treat most professors these days.
That's right.
The pay was very, very low, and it was half the time it was late. It was paid once a semester, you know, which made it just awfully, awfully difficult to live on. So,
but you had the title.
I had the title.
You had the title. You had the title.
Yeah, I had the title and the headaches and the politics.
you mentioned one thing there really quick, honor seminars. What was that about?
Well, at one point, my dad suffered a bad stroke, and it required me to move away from Tulsa and cut down my teaching load in Tulsa so that I could be closer to Topeka and help my mom out. And I took a little job at a little radio station in Chanute, Kansas, and then I cut down my teaching load and had every intention of quitting teaching. So I talked the classics dean at the time at the University of Oklahoma into allowing me to teach a philosophy honors seminar class as kind of a farewell, you know, to academia. And that class was basically kind of a broad look at medieval European history from the Eastern European Orthodox point of view, which most people are not familiar with and exposed to. And that eventually proved to be kind of a popular class. There have been lecture notes and transcriptions of that class that have been circulating kind of underground and online for a number of years. But after my dad passed, I returned very briefly to teaching full-time back in Tulsa. And then we had a change of deans, and the dean that replaced the old dean that was my boss, a really fine man by the name of Dr. George Henderson, he reorganized the whole department, cut out my position. So at that point, I just kind of gave up the academic world and became a casino manager, believe it or not.
Was that the epiphany I was searching for?
Well, in many ways, it was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the wind out of your sails.
And that was the wind out of the
sails. So, right. and at this point, were you starting to accrue your fascination with all things ancient and Giza and the mystic schools? Was this starting to surface?
No. That interest has always been there since childhood. You know, I always had kind of this I don't know how to describe it. A fascination for the, you know, what is now qualified as the alternative research community. You know, I was always interested in things like Atlantis and Plato's dialogues about it, and always interested in Giza and the Nazis and strange science and inventions and physics. My dad was an engineer, and he and my parents' good card-playing friends, the husband of that couple was also an engineer. So when I was a kid, you know, when they were playing cards, you know, they talked shop.
right.
So many a conversation was had over the card playing table as I was listening as a little boy. You know, my dad and this engineer would talk about the Great Pyramid and how none of it made much sense from an Egyptological point of view, and so I was always kind of exposed to that sort of stuff.
It's so funny that you said that, because my mom and her friends would do the same thing. When I was a little kid in the 60s, they would, you know, play pinochle and bridge and stuff in the dining room. And us kids were, you know, forced to watch TV and play. But I would listen to my mom and Aunt Z argue about Edgar Casey and the Sphinx all night long. You know, and I was just always had one ear trained to the dining room. And, you know, I'm 8 years old. Who's this Edgar Casey guy? Wow. Okay. But yeah, the same thing. And it's strange how you, you're influenced at a young age, and you can't let it go. Why didn't you try to pursue teaching some alternative fringe stuff in college?
Well, as an adjunct professor, you know, your job is always dependent on how many students sign up for your courses.
That's right.
So you're always in the position, you don't want to rock the boat. You know, if you're a tenured professor, it's a different matter. You can get things or sneak things in. And I'm not saying I didn't do that occasionally in my classes, you know, just toss something out and hope that students would pick up on it and go out and research it on their own. But you're always hesitant to try and stick your neck out too far when, you know, your livelihood and rent payments and food payments and everything else are dependent. So I minded my P's and Q's very carefully. Although that said, once I had begun teaching for the University of Oklahoma, one of the courses that I taught was team taught with a professor from the University of Tulsa, a professor of biology. And she and I got along just really well. We worked well together, and we handled the interdisciplinary seminar in this particular course of studies at the University of Oklahoma. And she had an interest, believe it or not, in kind of strange things and alternative history and stuff like that. And to make a long story short, over lunch one day during our break, we were talking about the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, and so on, and I was outlining my radical, wild, and crazy weapon hypothesis, and she says, "Oh, you've got to present that to the class."
Right on.
So she twisted my arm, actually, and I did a presentation one weekend of about two and a half hours long on that hypothesis, and the students loved it. And after I finally quit teaching, she emailed me, and a close friend of mine at the time was on my back, you know, "Well, you've got nothing to lose now that you're out of academia. You might as well publish a book about it." So I did, and that's how all this got started.
And so the reaction from the students, I have to say, was that one of the things that lets you know that maybe you were on target? Because we always have questions inside of ourselves.
Right. Well, it let me know I was on target insofar as they showed a great interest in the subject matter itself. I kind of felt that they had intuited that there was something wrong with standard explanations of the structure. I'm not certain that they bought into my hypothesis fully, and, you know, nor should they. But the really shocking thing to me was the interest in the subject matter itself, and the interest in something that was not following a standard academic model of interpretation of it. And and I thought, well, that's interesting. And I finally cranked up the courage to write down my kooky ideas.
Yeah.
The Giza Death Star book, and sent it off to Adventures Unlimited. And David Childress, the owner of that publishing house, asked me to fund the printing cost for that book. And he said, if it sells, then, you know, we'll be happy to publish any follow-up books you want to do. And it did, and that's how all this got started.
Let me ask you about that, because Giza sure. Death Star was it seemed to again, I'm going to say this, take this the correct way, it came out of nowhere. It was talking about some pretty strange things and a little bit out there.
Oh, but way out there.
Yeah, way out there.
Don't have to mince words on my account.
And it opened up a lot of eyes, including my own. And how was the reception?
Well, it, like I say, the book sold well. I'll be frank and tell you that certain people, I won't mention their names, in the alternative research community, sent me angry emails. Because, of course, the whole hypothesis of it being perhaps a massively sophisticated weapon of some sort, using physics conceptions that we haven't arrived at yet, or are just on the cusp of arriving at, that whole idea touched a nerve. It really did in some of the researchers in the alternative community. And they sent me angry emails, and I realized that what I was really doing was I was calling into question the whole idea that all of this ancient society, ancient high wisdom, you know, was all jonquils and daisies. And, you know, as I put it in that book, from the time I was a kid listening to my father and his card-playing friend talk, the problem with that was that I never felt intuitively anything really good about the structure, and I still don't to this day. And, you know, I realize that runs counter to what many people feel and intuit about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I realized that at that point, you know, that there was something amiss, perhaps, in the perception of ancient legends and societies. You know, my exposure to patristics and some other ancient literature, you know, it's rather obvious once you're familiar with the text that they don't paint a picture that's all rosy and jonquils and daisies. So I had it in my mind that if the Giza Death Star sold well, that I would do some sequels. I had in my head that I wanted to follow it up with a series of books. And that's one thing people have to realize about my books. They're all kind of interrelated to each other, and they're laid out in kind of a deliberate sequence. You can read them in any order you want to, but they all kind of plug into each other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the Great Pyramid, we lots of great ideas, but we really don't know. We don't know anything really about it. We don't know how it was built. We don't know when it was built. We don't know. We know as much today as we did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 100 years ago, 2,000 years ago. That it just appeared in the desert, you know, and that's just the way that it is. So all theories, anything, Christopher Dunn, Brian Forrester, whoever you want to point at, Carmen, anybody out there that has ideas, they're all on the table, and we need to listen to them all, including Giza Death Star.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Chris Dunn. I met Mr. Dunn shortly after Giza Death Star was published, and David Childress invited us both to be speakers at a conference he was hosting. And I was just, I got to tell you, I was just nervous as all get out about meeting him, because I have very high regard for the Giza power plant and the work that he did in that book.
Absolutely.
The work that he's done as follow-up to it. And, you know, I was just dreading, you know, meeting him, because I thought, oh, he's just going to read me the riot act, you know, for what I had said and how I had kind of played off of his book a bit, and quite the contrary. He was very gentlemanly. He was very warm and cordial and receptive to the ideas, and so that kind of reassured me. And it was after that meeting I decided, well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and write the other books I want to write about all this.
And with I've listened to your interviews a lot over the years, and the one question always comes back. So I'm going to ask you this. You've answered this 100 times, but maybe your answer might be a little different tonight. What weapon was it? What type of weapon? Have you thought about this a little bit more? What when we say a weapon,
right?
What are you thinking today?
Well, to be honest, if I were to do those three books today, I would write them much differently, because I was very hesitant in those books at coming right out and saying what I think it may have been. But basically, I believe that the whole concept hovers around three basic ideas, and the first is that it's a coupled harmonic oscillator to the geometries of local celestial space. And if that's the case, then it's manipulating energies and phenomena on a very, very massive scale. The second thing I think that it would have been based on, to put it in modern physics terms, is the phenomenon of entanglement, but entanglement at a much larger scale than the quantum scale. The third thing I think probably is at work in it is that it was manipulating longitudinal waves in the physical medium itself, in the ether, or in the fabric of space-time, or the quantum vacuum flux, whatever you wish to call it. And when I say longitudinal waves, if people don't understand what I mean by that...
Explain this really well. So yeah, go ahead, take a few minutes.
If people are familiar with Nikola Tesla's Colorado Springs experiments and some of the things that he was saying, I think what he was talking about was a very similar phenomenon. A longitudinal wave, let's do what I call the jump rope analogy. The electromagnetic energy that people think of when they think of radio waves or radar or microwaves or what have you, it's a Hertz wave. So you can envision what a Hertz wave does by taking a jump rope and suspending it between two people. And one person jerks the wave up and down, and you'll get a typical S wave or sine wave that travels from the person jerking it to the other person. Now, in that kind of wave, what's very obvious is that very little energy is transmitted to the person at the other end. Most of the energy is lost in the jerking motion itself, the transverse motion. Now, a longitudinal wave is a pressure wave like sound. It's a wave of rarefaction and compression. So to understand what a longitudinal, if you can think of it this way, think of it as kind of an electrical acoustic wave. So you suspend a ruler between two people and have the person at one end pulse the ruler, and all that energy is transmitted to the other person at the moment of the pulse itself. So you're making certain assumptions, obviously, about the physical medium there that may or may not be true. Is the physical medium a non-compressible medium, and so on and so forth? And that debate's been going on for a long time. But that's the basic difference between a Hertz wave and a longitudinal wave. And I think that the pyramid, the indicators to me that I kind of looked at in those three books, the indicators to me are it's doing one or possibly some combination of all three things that would have made it work. So in other words, it's not a weapon like a gun. It's not something that you point and aim. It's more like a weapon like holding keys of the piano down silently and then striking another key, and you'll hear the harmonic overtone vibrating sympathetically. So you kind of dial it up and tune it in rather than point and aim.
Do you think it would ever be possible to get that thing fired up again?
No. I talk about that in a brief way at the end of the Giza Death Star, but I talk about it in a major way in another book in the series called The Cosmic War. And I take off from Chris Dunn here. Chris Dunn has that diagram in the Giza power plant,
mm-hmm.
where he outlines his hypothesis that he thinks the Grand Gallery was filled with Helmholtz resonators that at some point, for whatever reason, were removed from the structure. And he thinks that there are other things removed. And interestingly enough, Zechariah Sitchin, in his Wars of Gods and Men, looks at texts and comes to the same conclusion. And I look at other texts in the Cosmic War and come to very similar conclusions, that there are components of the structure that were deliberately removed, some of them destroyed, some of them hidden. So in other words, what you're looking at Giza with the Great Pyramid is the shell of a machine. It would only be partially functional, in other words.
With your research, are you leaning on, I'll give you my ideas here in a second, are you thinking 10,000, 15,000 BC as a construction point for the pyramid or beyond that?
With the Great Pyramid, I think beyond that.
Yeah.
I do. I kind of follow the thinking of Alan Alford here. I think there's probably, if you look at the Giza compound, I think there's probably three levels, chronologically speaking, of construction there. The Great Pyramid being the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
The second pyramid and some of the other structures being the second oldest layer, and then Mycenaeus and then some of the other structures being the most recent layer. But there are indicators. Mr. Dunn, if I remember correctly, has done some research recently that suggests that there are other structures there that show similar, like the Valley Temples and so on, that show similar engineering skills to the Great Pyramid. So you'd have to date, if you're taking that as an indicator of the antiquity of what you're looking at, then you'd have to look at those things as being dated in the same time frame as the Great Pyramid.
And one last question. We'll come back to this later on in the show. When it comes to the Sphinx, what do you think the relationship is to the Great Pyramid, and what's your take there?
Well, I think from what I understand of Dr. Schock's research there and John Anthony West's summarization of it, I think it's possible that the Sphinx looks like something that would belong to the second tier of construction or to the second period. In other words, the same time frame approximately, very loosely, as the second big pyramid at Giza. But that said, we're making assumptions about the geological history of the era, too.
Right.
And I think you have to hold open the possibility that it might be a much older structure.
Do you think the two worked together in any way? You needed one for the other to operate?
No, I haven't, I'm not opposed to that idea, but I have no idea how that would work. But I didn't find any, at least in the way I approached the Great Pyramid weapon hypothesis, I didn't find anything that immediately suggested to me in the texts or anything like that, that it contributed some functional purpose to the structure.
You know what? Okay, let me get this out of the way. This is Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We are talking with Joseph P. Farrell. You can shoot me an email to jimmy@jimmychurchradio.com. You can also follow us on Twitter right now at jchurchradio, where I've got an imposter tonight that just popped in, Dr. Farrell. How cool is that? You know, you know you've arrived if you've got an imposter. We'll take a hard break in a half hour. How's that? And then I want to stay on this for a second.
Sure.
In the Cosmic War, uh-huh. you tie in, and I think it's one of the, man, I've listened to so many interviews with you discussing this, and I'm so excited that I actually get to sit down and talk to you about it one-on-one. You tie in the possibility of the Giza pyramids with a possibility of an inter-solar system war here
right.
Amongst the planets. And how did you get to that point? Because it's you can draw the parallels and the connections very easily in the way that you put it together. But where did this start? Where did it come from?
Well, for me, it came from looking at some Mesopotamian texts, and in the Cosmic War, I derive a kind of a formula, because when you look at those texts, what they do is they have, a multi-textured constellation of relationships. You always see references to the gods being spoken in terms of mountains. Mountains is another word for pyramids. And then you have clear indications in some Mesopotamian texts that these gods are fighting over mountains. They're fighting over pyramids. And in point of fact, they're fighting with them. And then the final little clue is that you also have to remember that the gods' names also stand for planets in many cases. So you've got a very unusual constellation of relationships. You've got pyramids, mountains, planets, gods.
Mm-hmm.
And once you put it in that context and then start reading the texts from what I call a kind of paleophysics point of view, in other words, they're trying to describe in the language available to them technologies that seem magical. So it looks to me, you know, taking these things seriously for a moment, that they're describing a cosmic war. They're describing an interplanetary war of some sort that's being fought with some pretty horrific weapons.
Right.
And that's basically how I came to that conclusion.
Was it just one set of text, or was it different civilizations too as well, referencing the same thing?
Different civilizations. In that particular book, I talk about the Edfu temple texts. I talk about some Ugaritic texts. I talk about the Epic of Ninurta, which, you know, the odd thing about the Epic of Ninurta, and I put the whole thing in the Cosmic War just to make people sit down and actually read this, because I defy anybody to explain how this constitutes an epic. It's like reading the index to the Sears catalog.
Right. totally.
It's about that exciting. I mean,
well, it depends on who's reading it, because for me, well, it's exactly right there. It's a page turner. So
yeah, exactly. What you have in that text is essentially an inventory of basically the technologies of the losers in this war, and it's being inventoried, and they're telling you what they're going to do with all this stuff. And it's interesting because, you know, I draw the analogy many times to World War I after the German capitulation. Well, what did the Allies do? Well, you can't build these things. You can't build those things. You can have only a really tiny army. And we're going to send inspectors in to make darn sure you don't, you know.
Right, and it didn't work.
And it didn't work too well, right. No.
Oh, man.
But you see the same thing going on here in this text. They're taking an inventory of the technologies of the vanquished, and they're carting off some of the technologies to be used elsewhere. They're destroying some others, and then there's a very peculiar class of things that cannot be destroyed, so they simply hide them. So, you know, it's a strange mix.
And also, the asteroid belt that is out there is I know you referenced this. So, is that the end result? Was that the end of the cosmic war?
Yeah, I think I rely a lot on the work of Dr. Tom Van Flandern, late Dr. Tom Van Flandern, and his exploded planet hypothesis. And basically all he did was he revived the hypothesis of late 18th, early 19th century astronomers that concluded, well, the asteroid is a blown-up planet that should have been there by our astronomical laws. And he kind of revived and updated that hypothesis. So, you know, I think given the text, given some of his arguments, it dovetails rather nicely.
And what, let's put a timeline on that. What, when, as far as history goes, this, the cosmic war and the losing of a planet that was out there, which is constantly talked about in ancient texts too, as well.
Right.
What timeline are we putting on this?
Well, this is where it gets difficult. This is an important subject to talk about because, on the one hand, if you start taking these ancient texts at their word, you would have to contend, first of all, with the Sumerian kings list. And when you look at that, it dates the beginning of civilization to about 240,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the geological and astronomical evidence, the first thing you have to look at is what Dr. Van Flandern did with his exploding planet hypothesis. He came to the conclusion that an exploding planet would explain the wild, crazy elliptical orbits of comets. And so he ran a computer program of the orbits of comets, tracing them back to a point of origin within the asteroid belt that fell at about 65 million years ago. And another possible point of concurrence about 3.2 million years ago. So just as a matter of expedience, because I make no attempt in the cosmic war, and people have to understand this, I make no attempt to try to reconcile the chronological part of this. I'm simply painting in very, very broad strokes. But I went for the 3.2 million year date because it would seem to be much more easily or readily encompassed in a macro history of human prehistory rather than that 65 million year date. So in other words, you've got a huge gap of history that you've got to fill in. So let's make the gap smaller.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, and it's kind of strange how they just tie into all of the major seminal events here on Earth.
Right.
And,
right.
And Mars falls into that category too, immediately.
Right. Right. Well, there's another chronological difficulty. If you look at the work of Dr. Mark Carlotto that assisted Mr. Hoagland for a number of years, he comes up with dates, if I remember correctly, and please don't cite my faulty memory here, but if I remember correctly, he comes up with dates between about 650,000 to 150,000 years ago. So those are much more in line with this, with the ancient text aspect of the data set. The problem is you've got astronomical data, you've got geological data on Mars, you've got geological data on Earth, and that's one data set that's indicating that this catastrophe occurred quite some time ago. And then on the other hand, you've got the textual data set.
That's right.
And, you know, reconciling these three different things is just monstrously difficult. And well, it may be the case that they can't be reconciled.
Okay. These questions are coming in on Twitter from so many different people, but so I have to address this really quick.
Sure.
What's the tie-in with Nibiru?
Well, I am not a... people have to understand, I'm not a Sitchinite. I have too many problems with the broad scenario that he paints. I'm not a believer in Nibiru because the way he describes it in his books, if I remember correctly, he's got the planet careening into the solar system from below the plane of the ecliptic and coming through perpendicular to the plane of the ecliptic of the planets that are rotating around the sun about once every 3,160 years, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have that kind of periodicity to it, what that would mean in terms of the physical mechanics involved is you'd see the planets bobbing in their orbits like, you know, bobbers, fishing bobbers on a pond,
mm-hmm.
Responding to waves, because that kind of activity would produce those kinds of gravitational waves, and you don't see that. So I've always had a big problem with that whole scenario. I just don't see the physics signature of that. But the other problem I have with, and I'm not trying to, please don't get me wrong here, I'm not trying to denigrate Mr. Sitchin. I mean, he uncovered a wealth of details.
Yes, he did, and we're not trying to do that at all. No,
we're not trying to do that. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just saying I disagreed with his macro scenario. The other problem I have with it is he's talking in terms of nuclear weapons and so on, which in my reading of the text, I don't think you're dealing merely with nuclear weapons. I think you're dealing with other kinds of weapons that are far more sophisticated, far more destructive. You would certainly need those kinds of weapons if you're going to blow up a planet.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he has all of this inter-commercial, interplanetary commerce taking place with rocket ships. And that's just Pony Express if you're going to have an interplanetary civilization.
You know what, though? It's mighty good reading.
It's mighty good reading.
It's mighty good reading. And there's... when you're dealing with a 3,600-year, 3,150-year orbit, well, then that takes the asteroid belt or the question of that being Nibiru at one point out of the mix, because that was certainly much longer before that.
Right.
There was another question here. Hold on. Somebody wanted me to ask you about... let's back up just really quick. This is just a quick answer. What are the relevance of the capstones of the pyramids in Giza?
Well, that's another very interesting question. You can read some ancient sources that describe the Great Pyramid at one time. Herodotus, I believe, you can find some mention of these types of things in Plutarch and so on. Even if my always unreliable memory serves me correctly in Diodorus Siculus, but at one point the pyramid is described with its casing stones still on it, covered with hieroglyphics, with in some versions a kind of quartz capstone.
Right.
In other cases, a gold capstone. And somewhere, and I don't know where, I don't think it was in an ancient source, someone proposed the idea it was quartz encased in gold. Well, the interesting thing, quartz makes sense because the Great Pyramid is inclined at 51 degrees so many minutes and seconds. And if you look at the angle of inclination of the end of a quartz crystal, it's 51 degrees. So it would make perfect sense. In other words, the pyramid is built as kind of a huge artificial quartz, and it's built out of quartz-bearing stone, limestone and granite. So it would make sense if you had the technology to grow a quartz that big that, you know, you're going to plop a quartz on top of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've always dreamt or visioned it being clear. Yeah. I don't know why. I don't know why. Crystalline, clear, right. Maybe glass-like too as well. And I've always envisioned that. I don't know if it has to do with the Luxor in Vegas.
It's interesting that you say that because Herodotus, I think it was, describes seeing the pyramid back in the day that it had its casing stones still on it. And he describes it as being as bright as the sun and visible from a tremendous distance away. So, you know, if there was a quartz capstone on top, yeah, I can see it being clear and,
yeah,
and quite bright.
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from, but that's I don't see in my mind's eye, I don't see it being gold. I don't know what that would do unless we're thinking more like antenna. You know, some type of electrical thing, but I don't know. I just see it as being clear, and Herodotus said it right. And when he describes it, and I've read it so many times about being able to see it from such a great distance, and it was as bright as the sun. I just always refer back to the possibility of it being clear, some type of giant crystal on the top of the Great Pyramid.
Right. Well, we have to remember that the Great Pyramid is a crystal.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's a gigantic, huge artificial crystal.
Let's Let's do that. Oh, you know what? We'll take the hard break in 10 minutes. I was going to change subjects at the hard break, but this is a good point to ask this. I want to move into a little bit of a more modern context, but
all right.
with what the Germans were doing, not only in Egypt but all around the world, you know, India, and you know, going out there and digging up and questioning and interviewing and collecting. I don't think they were the only ones doing it, by the way.
Oh, no.
But no, they weren't. But what? Why did they suddenly start this up with the Nazi Party? In other words, was there something that kicked things off for them to go, we need to go and get to this ancient information, and we need to do this now? What was the catalyst behind that?
Well, it's when you boil it right down to it, it's difficult to say. But I think there's several things you have to look at. Germany, from the time of Kant all the way up to modern times, Germany has been fascinated. It's just part of the German interest, the German culture, has been fascinated with ancient cultures. Von Schliemann, of course, you know, digging up Troy and things like that. Robert Koldova, you know, finding the Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
That's right.
And all of that stuff. When you look at the formation of the Nazi Party, however, you have to take into account that it was kind of midwifed into existence by a bunch of these interwar occult secret societies, the Thule Gesellschaft, the Friel Gesellschaft. There's just Germany was honeycombed with all sorts of secret societies. So he had a definite occult esoteric interest always kind of percolating in the background with the Nazi Party. I mean, my word, you can look at their big party rallies in Nuremberg and just see the ritual element involved in those things. But the other thing, you have a number of German physicists that begin to notice in the interwar period, one of them being Dr. Walter Gerlach, who I mentioned in SS of Brotherhood of the Bell. Well, this man was an internationally renowned physicist. He had been the assistant to Dr. Stern, who won eventually the Nobel Prize for his work in spin polarization. Well, Gerlach was heavily involved in that experiment. Gerlach, at a certain point, commented publicly in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung newspaper in Frankfurt during the interwar period about a phenomenon that researchers in Europe and in Germany in particular were noticing with their high voltage electrical experiments. They were experimenting with mercury plasma, and they would notice after their experiments they'd get minute little traces of gold from their experiments. So in other words, you know, transmutation of
right,
some sort was
right,
occurring.
Right.
And so Gerlach, you know, here's this internationally renowned physicist.
Yeah, pretty smart guy.
Very smart guy. Writes an article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. It's just a little kind of 2-inch column filler, you know. And he says, well, this is kind of interesting. You know, we ought to investigate this. And he comes right out and calls it a kind of alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
He uses that word.
Yes, he does. The German word for alchemy is alchemy, right?
Yeah, it's alchemy. Alchemy.
Right.
He said, you know, it's a typical scientist's plea. In other words, he's really saying the government ought to give us a lot of money so that we can find out what the heck is going on here. And it's interesting because that's also an indicator that you've got these very serious scientists that are looking at esoteric traditions. So along comes Heinrich Himmler, Reichsführer SS, and in 1935 he kind of begins his own personal office within the SS structure of occult investigations. And in 1940, after the war has begun, he signs a decree and he creates probably one of the most notorious departments of the SS called the Ahnenerbedienst. And in the decree in which he sets up this department, the department was instructed to do nothing but investigate all avenues of the occult, esoteric, ancient you know, lore, literature, traditions, and so on, to do two things. First of all, to prove the Aryan heritage and that it was once a global civilization. But the second thing, and the more interesting thing, is he says, we're going to be investigating all of this, pardon me, for its possible use in military applications. So in other words, somewhere in the mix inside of the Third Reich, pardon me, somewhere in the mix inside the Third Reich, you had somebody coming to the conclusion that these ancient texts and traditions contained clues to a lost science and clues to a lost military technology. So this was a huge part of the impetus behind the SS doing some of these things.
And what was strange, and I'm not going to belittle other countries' research, and I'm directly referring to the UK and the United States and France, and you know,
right.
There was a lot of brilliant things going on at this point in the world's history.
Yes.
But Germany, for some reason, had a bunch of really, really, really smart guys there at the exact same time.
Right.
And you combine that with their fascination with other things that we wouldn't consider around the world, the occult,
right.
Psychic powers, conversations, right. And channeling, and all of this. But they were willing to accept the merging, if you will, of these two ideals. And,
yes,
and then they had this explosion, for lack of a better term, explosion of knowledge, and they were able to apply it in so many different areas, not only with submarines and boats and planes and tanks and armaments, but obviously rocketry and and other sources of power. We'll talk about the bell here in a second, too, as well. A lot of things came out of this, and I don't want to belittle the rest of the world, but Germany was really laser-focused on this at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. It really was. Part of it comes out of, you know, dating all the way back to Frederick the Great, the founding of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, and that morphing into, of course, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, and the Germans being Germans, they stressed the physical sciences, chemistry, physics, and so on. So, you know, prior to World War II, if you wanted really to study with the cutting edge in theoretical physics or experimental physics, you went over and studied in Germany. Oppenheimer studied there. So, you know, that it was part of their culture. The other thing that I think contributed greatly to the particular German turn of mind that was able to create quantum mechanics and nuclear physics was Immanuel Kant, you know, the whole philosophical tradition of the Enlightenment in Germany, with the whole idea that space and time are really things that the mind imposes on reality to order it. Well, you know, you've laid the philosophical foundations right there for relativity. You've laid the philosophical foundations for quantum mechanics. So it was ingrained in German culture by that point. And the Nazis come along and basically recruit a lot of these top scientists and place them under the jurisdiction of the SS, which, oddly enough, frees them from the constraints of Nazi Party ideology. They're expected to brainstorm in very unusual, out-of-the-box ways. Kind of like DARPA.
Yeah, exactly. It was DARPA. And you just have the question has to be asked. Do you think they stumbled upon something in a cave in India? You know, was there something that was forcing this creativity to apply the hard science with, again, greatly thinking outside of the box?
My guess is at some point they may have. The Nazi expedition to Tibet, the Schaefer expedition in late 1938, early 1939, was able to bring out of the Potala an entire copy of the Tibetan Kong Shur. Now, rumor has it, I mean, I've never read the whole thing. I don't even think there's any complete translations out there. There are translations that claim to be complete, but I highly doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
Because this copy, I think, ran to something like 140 to 160 volumes, somewhere in there. And these volumes were thick, big, heavy, mm-hmm. wood-covered Tibetan books. Well, they brought this back to Nazi Germany. And at the end of the war, there's a story about the Russians entering Berlin and discovering about 1,000 Tibetan Buddhist monks in SS uniforms that had committed ritual suicide. So we're left with the question, how in the name of sense during World War II did the Germans get 1,000 Tibetan monks from Tibet all the way to Berlin? And what were they doing there? And my suspicion has always been that what they were doing was that they were helping the Germans translate their copy of the Kong Shur. Now, at the end of the war, another big, huge mystery. I've talked with Peter Lavenda and some other people about this. At the end of the war, apparently nobody knows what the heck happened to that copy of the Kong Shur. It just disappears. It just drops off the radar. I don't know if it ended up in this country, if the Nazis kept their hands on it and hid it somewhere. Nobody seems to know.
Right.
I suspect that those monks were brought out of Tibet sometime during 1941 or 42, and we can get into the details of that if you want on the other side of the break.
But. Yeah. Let's go ahead and take a break right now. We'll be back right after the break with Joseph P. Farrell. This is Fade to Black, only on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And when we come back, somebody just... It's the obvious question right there. Then how come they lost the war? We'll also answer that when we come back. We'll be back in a few. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. This is Rob Halford, the Metal God, on JimmyChurchRadio.com.
What's up? My name's Brian Taylor, Ninja Badass Extraordinaire, and this is JimmyChurchRadio.com.
KJCR, in your face.
JimmyChurchRadio.com.
On the Dark Matter Radio Network.
Ah, yeah, Fade to Black, only on the Dark Matter Radio Network. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, lighting it up tonight with Joseph P. Farrell, and we're going to be all over the place tonight because there's only so much time, and I have a million questions, and I will try to toe the rope here and try to keep this focused. I will do my best. Are you with us, Dr. Farrell?
Sure am.
Okay. So... Let's kind of summarize here. We talked about Giza. We talked about India. We've talked about Mesopotamia. We've talked about Sumerian text. We've talked about some of the knowledge that goes out there. We were talking 250,000, maybe even 400,000 years old civilization going back that far. And this ancient knowledge has come and gone probably 3, 4, 5, 6 times before it disappeared altogether. But this knowledge is out there, and here comes along a couple of societies, the Thule Society, we can talk about that right now, and Vril pops up, and this crazy turn of physics and electronics that is going down in Berlin, and it seems to be, again, I don't want to belittle what's going on around the world, because we're all fascinating with the atom at that point. And electricity in general, and chemistry, and science and space. But the hub seems to be in Berlin, and they make some fantastic leaps in technology in front of all of us, and we couldn't slow them down. And it just comes to one of those things. Maybe they had some help. Maybe they actually knew something. But the problem with that is, for me, is they believed in that, and they accepted the esoteric as well as the fringe as well as the hard black and white science. And right. that can be a problem.
Right. Right.
So,
well, you know, the Ananarba, the person that asked the question, why did they lose? We have to step back for a second. The Ananarba in the SS, and then another crucially important institution inside the Third Reich, which was totally secret. It was the Nazi version of DARPA. And in fact, I think DARPA was modeled on this outfit. It was called the Kammerstab. It was headed by an SS four-star general, a wicked man by the name of Dr. Hans Kammler. But Kammler basically took all of his scientists and technicians and freed them from Nazi party ideology and told them, in effect, to brainstorm the technology tree to second, third, and fourth generation weapons. You know, just lay it out. What do we need to do to get from here to there?
Can I ask you about Kammler for a second?
Sure.
Was he somebody that was he a causer, or was he actually some brains behind the operation too? Did he have hard scientific knowledge, or was he just a manipulator and a boss?
Kammler had a doctorate in engineering. You can get a doctorate in engineering in Germany, so he actually had a doctorate in engineering. Which is not an easy thing to get in that country, obviously.
Right.
So he did have some brains, but his principal role during the last part of the war was more of a manager and coordinator.
Exactly.
He managed all of the SS building and works departments. So in other words, this was the man that you went to if you wanted to tap into that vast slave labor pool. And we need to stop and understand how huge that was. It was some 14 million people.
Right, right, right.
So in other words, this guy is the coordinator. The brains in his outfit are really the scientists and technicians that he has working on all of these weapons. And just every conceivable kind of weapon that you can think of. In fact, the prototypes really of many of the weapons that we're using today. So, you know, kind of Mark I generation stuff back then.
All of it.
Jet aircraft, you know. Jet
rockets, missiles, radar.
Yep. You know.
Radios.
Lasers, over-the-horizon radars, you know, the whole nine yards. I mean.
guided missiles, television, you know.
Television, guided missiles, acoustic homing torpedoes, you know, wire-guided missiles, you know. It's just.
And it all looked really cool, too. I don't want to. You know what I'm saying.
Did.
You know what I'm saying. So
yeah, I do.
I'm sorry, I missed the Twitter name, but when they ask, you know, how did they lose the war? That's one of the things that blows my mind. Yeah. Is how can this tiny little small country take on a war on practically four fronts, north, south, east, and west, and kick the crap out of everybody? And that's what they brought Russia to their knees. And
you know, that most people don't know that Stalin offered to sue for peace in August of 1941, and Hitler turned him down. You know, Hitler was kind of a victim of his own success.
Right. Yes. And it's scary. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It is. The real problem I think people have that they've got to confront, and I begin my book, The Nazi International, with this, is if you look at the surrender instruments, the surrender on May 7th that was signed by Colonel General Jodl mm-hmm. in Reims, and then the surrender in Berlin the following day, where you had Field Marshal Keitel and Admiral Friedeberg and General Stumpf signing for the three service branches of the Wehrmacht. The problem is that there is nobody signing those surrender instruments representing the Reich government, and there is nobody signing those surrender instruments on behalf of the Nazi Party, and that's a crucial point.
How so?
Well, the reason why is the Nazi Party doesn't surrender. It just goes into exile. It goes underground. So, in other words, as far as that post-war Nazi outfit is concerned, they are still there. They are still, in a certain sense, at war.
As an ideology, as a belief?
As an ideology, as an ideology. As I put it in the Nazi International, what you're dealing with is not just a bunch of Nazis huddled in their caves in Latin America. What you're dealing with is a post-war extraterritorial state that has no center and no borders, and that is highly organized and extremely well-funded. So they don't go quietly into the night. That's the impression that everybody has, but it's a false impression, unfortunately. So it's a very interesting thing when you look at it. And the other problem with the whole Nazi development is that there are certain key strategic decisions that Hitler himself made during the war that cost him the war.
You're referring to Moscow?
I'm referring to the turn of the second Panzer Army south in August of 1941 to encircle Marshal Budini's forces at Kiev.
That's the one that's the one he wants back.
Yeah.
that's the one he wants back. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. And a number of other blunders that really crippled the German secret weapons timetable. And then the thing that people have to remember is that his strategic blunders in the 1942 offensive that ultimately led to the Stalingrad disaster. Again, you know, these were decisions that really cost him the war.
You may be alluding to this, but so I might actually speed this up and go right to it. What about the rumor of the possibility of using, you know, maybe some primitive nuclear weapons on some of those fronts? Because, you know, it was such a large, you know, you're talking about the border with the Soviet Union and also the amount of miles going into the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah.
And Walter just tweeted, Walter, I'll give you credit here. He also brought up Kursk, which was a big turning point in the war too.
Yes.
I've heard those rumors out there that possibly something crazy was used on the fields in Kursk.
Okay. This is a really excellent question, because if you look at the gruesome statistics of World War II, fully half, if not more, than the casualties of World War II were suffered by the Russians.
That's
and inflicted right. inflicted by the Wehrmacht on the Russians. Now, if you look at normal military operations
and numbers
in plain numbers, German army right up to the end of the war had a 1 to 1.5 kill ratio against all combatants, which is huge, but that would not explain the just huge suffering. Into the millions.
Yes.
On the Eastern Front. So I have always thought and felt that there had to have been something else going on that the Germans were doing on the Eastern Front that they were not willing to do against the Western Allies. And lo and behold, if you read Otto Skorzeny's memoirs, the famous SS Colonel Commando, he, in his memoirs, talks about the fact that during the German offensive in 1941 against Moscow, the Germans were using some of their naval Werfer rocket artillery units to hurl essentially what were liquid air bombs. In other words, they were fuel air bombs, folks. And if you don't know what a fuel air bomb is,
it's big.
Yes. It's the size of a tactical nuke.
Sure.
Now, if you can imagine these six barrel, 28 centimeter German naval
hurling those.
At the poor Russians.
Yes.
Well, the Russians at one point, you know, got so sick of this, they told the Germans via Sweden that if you kept up this, we're going to go to poison gas, you know, and so the Germans relented for a moment. Then there were rumors that I reproduce in Reich of the Black Sun, a cable that was intercepted from the Japanese military attaché in Stockholm to Tokyo, dated in 1943, I believe it was, that told Tokyo that the Germans were using some sort of atomic weapon on the Eastern Front, and that they had used it in the Crimea, which I think probably may have been the siege of Sevastopol, when von Manstein just took every big, huge piece of artillery that he could lay his hands on in the German arsenal, and they had, you know, they had just these enormous field pieces, 16-inch mortars, 24-inch mortars,
yeah.
31-inch railway gun, you know.
Was there ever any radiation measurements taken during the war?
No, not to my knowledge, but, you know, what the point here is that you have these rumors that the Germans were using some sort of primitive nuclear weapon on the Eastern Front.
Right.
And that's the great mystery, because, of course, the Allied post-war legend is that, you know, the Germans were nuclear bunglers, and, you know, they didn't even know how to design a reactor properly, and that's why they never got the bomb, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. That's why we got our fuses from them.
Yeah, that's why we got our fuses from them.
Yeah. Let's just be real here for a second. Oh, man. okay, you and I get that. The audience had just might have been right past him, but you understand where I was going.
I understand where you're going. You want me to talk about that?
Well, no, we can't. You know what? We can. Well, see. Well, let's actually back up now. Sure. And this is a good. You know, we kind of got ahead of ourselves. So let's back up. Let's talk about the Vril for a second, because I think this is my opinion. I think the Vril's been a little exaggerated.
Oh, I do too.
Oh, you do? Okay, good.
Yeah, I do too.
I think it's a little exaggerated. Again, good reading. It's fascinating. I remember the first time I read about the Vril, I'm like, man, you're kidding. This is the answer to everything. Okay, all right. But I think now, with all the research that I have done, and other researchers too, that the Vril is just turning out to be just a pretty good story. Yes?
Yeah, there's a lot, I think, to be honest with you, Jimmy, there's a lot of intentional deflection, stories that have been intentionally put out there to keep people from doing the hard work of trying to reverse engineer what exactly the Nazis were up to and why and where were they getting their ideas. I think there's been a lot of intentional deception.
Deflection, deception.
Yeah.
I got
exactly.
You. Okay.
But I think you have to look rather at the correspondence that people like Dr. Gerlach was having with some Austrian physicists by the name of Lenze and Turing. Pardon me. And I think you have to look at certainly a key figure, as far as I'm concerned, is the Hungarian electrical engineer by the name of Gabriel Krohn, who ends up in this country working for General Electric on some pretty classified things.
One would have to ask why, but let's get to that. Yeah, let's get to that.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah, let's get to that.
In 1935, I talk about this in my book, Secrets of the Unified Field. It's kind of an overlooked book in my series, but it's a very important one. In 1935, Gabriel Krohn wrote a paper about electrical anomalies in large networked electrical systems, phase creep and so on and so forth. And he concluded that you could take, and I hope people follow me very carefully here, he concluded that you could take the tensor calculus of, you know, of Einstein's general relativity.
Right.
And bring it down to the laboratory bench and use it to show why this creep was happening. Now,
interesting.
To put it differently, what he's really said was, first of all, there is some sort of electrogravitic coupling phenomenon that nobody really understands.
What year is this?
This is 1935.
Yeah, wow, that's... Yeah, okay.
And the second thing he's telling you is that you can engineer, you don't have to have, this you'll hear from physicists all the time, those interwar unified field theories were incomplete. But what Krohn really was saying was, well, they may be incomplete, but they're nonetheless engineerable. And he wins a prize at the University of Liège in Belgium for this paper, the Montefiore Prize. And, of course, Liège being, you know, close to the German border, at that instant, bang, at that instant, inside of Nazi Germany, publication on unified field theories in the physics journals stops. So, in other words, I think it goes deeply black.
That's right.
Because what he's really, in effect, telling you is that with 1935 technology, you can engineer, to a certain degree, the fabric of space-time.
Everything. That's right. That's right. That's
right. And, of course, he ends up in this country working for, guess who? General Electric. So, and I think he has some hand somewhere, some hidden story or part that we don't know yet in the Philadelphia experiment. I really do, because this man was a genius. He really was.
Well, and then you have to look at GE and other corporations here and the leaps and bounds that they made. Yeah. And I'm not I don't want to say that we didn't have smart people here.
Oh no, we had very smart people.
We had very, very, very smart people here, but things happen. That 10-year period, 1932 to 1942, 1947, right in there, that we leapfrogged ourselves in technology. And just 10 years before 1932, you got to remember, there were still horses running around.
Right.
And we barely, flight was barely happening, and suddenly 10 years later, 15 years later, It's rockets and nuclear bombs, and it was a crazy leapfrog of technology for all of us.
Yep.
Now, back to the Vril. Okay, so the Vril, I want you to expand on this. I've done my share of research, but the Vril was still, that was a World War I situation, and the Vril was not a Nazi party situation. The Vril had already come and gone by the time the Nazis came to power. Am I correct?
Right. Well, it's another curious thing. Were they in existence or not? The fellow that broke the story about the Vril Society was the German rocket scientist Willy Ley, who left Nazi Germany. He was disgusted with the Nazis, so he emigrated to this country. So he was actually the first German rocket scientist in this country, and he's the one that told the story about the Vril Society. And the Vril Society published a short little pamphlet, I forget what it's called, the Urkraft Vril or something like that.
I've only seen the cover. I've never been able to read what's in the inside of it.
Well, the inside of it's only about 35 pages long, somewhere in there.
You've seen it? You've read the...
Oh, yeah, I've read it.
Okay.
This was published in Berlin by some small little publishing house, I think either in 1932 or shortly after the Nazis came to power, 1934, somewhere in there, in that time frame. So this is the only thing that we have to go on about the Vril Society, is this little publication talking about what effectively a physicist would call the ether or the zero-point energy or, quantum vacuum flux or what have you. But it's a very esoteric document. I mean, it doesn't get into any real scientific physics or concepts like that. But again, it's one of those societies like the Thule Gesellschaft and these little networks or knots of intellectuals and psychics and scientists and so on inside of Germany that are talking about these types of things. So I don't dismiss the notion that there was such a society, but I think it's been blown way out of proportion.
No direct influence, nothing like that.
Right.
What about, now I want to jump forward, what about the Vril flying saucers? The Vril 1 and the Vril 2.
The Hanabu.
Yeah, the Hanabu.
The Hanabu,
yes.
2 and the I talk about that at great length in saucers, swastikas, and psyops, and I'll be very blunt and honest here. I think all of that is a great big heaping steaming pile of horse pucky.
Oh, don't kill it for me. Don't do it.
I think that that was clever disinformation. I think it was a post-war CIA Nazi international psyop, in a certain sense, to convince the Soviets that the Allies had something way, way more sophisticated than the Soviet MiG jets. And I think also it was a kind of a deliberately concocted set of myths to keep people from looking at the actual hard science, which I think was represented by the Bell.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. Let's stay focused here on this.
Right.
So, Nazi flying saucers in World War II, yay or nay?
Nay.
What about
at least in the sense of a field propulsion saucer? I have no difficulty with the idea that they were experimenting with
turbofans
and jet suction saucers and suctioning the boundary layer and stuff like this. I have no difficulty in
but zero point energy, anti-gravity, leaving Earth's atmosphere type of stuff. No. What about the photographs that we've seen floating out on the web with you know, saucers with Panzer cannons on them and stuff
like
that?
Well, again, I think that I've seen those things myself, and in fact, my publisher put some of those pictures in my first book on the Nazis, thinking that I was all for that idea, and he did that without my permission. And you know, I just pitched a hissy fit. I said, no, you know, don't do that because that's just all bunk. You know, you can make up photos and do all that, but assuming for the moment that they're real, why would you put a Panther tank turret upside down on a flying saucer and then expect to be able to use the dang thing?
Because it looks cool.
Because it looks cool, but that's I don't see it as much of a functional weapon system. That's the problem.
Well, you know what the problem is that when we look at the other technology, the common stuff, like their tank designs, their gun designs, their uniform designs, their airplanes and the submarine, everything was so advanced. That when we look at the flying wings, the jets, the 262, when you look at all of that, then it's not a leap of faith to think that they were working on crazy. The Bell aside, but it's not a leap of faith to believe that they were working on this type of technology, and they probably had it.
Well, I think I think it is a leap of faith because it's too big of a leap.
You think it's gullibility on our part?
Yeah, I really do. Because to get that kind of field propulsion with 1935 technology or 1940, you know, all of that, the first problem you're going to have is going to require an enormous amount of energy, just huge amounts. The capacitor technology, the battery technology, I just don't see as having existed at that time. The reason I have so many difficulties with it is there's no provenance or there's no attempt in the Hanabu and Vril story to reverse engineer a possible physics behind it. This is my hugest problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to make these claims, then point to me the engineering papers, point to me the scientists that you think did all this, and the people that they're pointing to as being responsible for these things are people that have no real track record. You can't point to them and say, well, yeah, this was a scientist that had published in such and such a field and had an established track record in it. There's nothing like that with this. You've got a bunch of pictures and a bunch of drawings and a bunch of claims using a lot of language that sounds scientific but really says nothing.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why I respect your research. You don't want to jump on the bandwagon just to be sensationalistic.
Right.
And agree with somebody when it just comes down to, you know, some serious black and white issues here. And you keep saying provenance, but that is so important here. And that's one of the reasons why I respect you so much. I just, it takes in this little small community of ours, you know, it's sometimes it takes some stones to go out and say, hey, you know what? Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, probably not. Let's just take a deep breath here. But again, you know, it's a great movie. It's a great book.
it's a great novel.
It's a great novel. With that, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and let's jump into the bell, because you're one of the most researched guys on that. When you and I were talking earlier today, I said, "Hey, man, let's just do a whole bell show tonight," and we didn't get to it.
We didn't get to it. Well, we'll have to do another one.
Well, we'll be back right after this. Everybody, stay with us. This is Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Our guest is Joseph P. Farrell. We're talking everything tonight. Giza, Nazi technology, the age of man. We'll be back right after this. Stay with us.
Jimmy Church.
My name is Alan, and I listen to JimmyChurchRadio.com.
He's always giving it to you straight.
JimmyChurchRadio.com.
On the Dark Matter Radio Network.
Hi, this is Rob Reiner from Anvil, and you're listening to JimmyChurchRadio.com.
What's up? I'm Chris.
What up? This is Kyle Massey, and you're listening to Jimmy Church Radio, the revolution.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Fade to Black, only on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Shoot me an email to Jimmy at JimmyChurchRadio.com. You can certainly come and hang out with us right now on Twitter, at JChurchRadio. Had an imposter earlier tonight. Tried to call himself Real Jimmy Church. Please. I would never call myself real. That'd be the last thing that I would call myself. So anyway, yeah, totally fun tonight. Again, I want to make sure that everybody gets over to JimmyChurchRadio.com. We've got the new website launched, and try to break it. Click on everything if you can. Jump around. Shoot me some email off of the contact page. Get that over to WoWo. And like I said, click on every little button, every little thing. If something doesn't work, let us know. It's a complex site, and we just want to make sure that it is up and running in the next couple of days, and it's 100%. All right, let's see, at J Church Radio, that's Twitter, hashtag DM Radio Net. We are speaking with Joseph P. Farrell. Now, with Dr. Farrell tonight, we've touched upon what I wanted to try to do, is I wanted to lay out things in a linear fashion, kind of like what we had to do when we had Peter Lavenda on last month, because there's so much information coming together from so many different directions, but in the end, it all kind of comes back and ties together. So it was a complex conversation tonight, but so I want to kind of recap a little bit and where we are right now, which is we talked about ancient technology, high technology, the mystic schools, Giza, India. Well, we didn't get into Greece, but I wanted to get into that too as well. But Sumeria, Iraq, ancient texts. And all of the mystic schools and the knowledge and everything and how it has come together in modern society today and where we are right now. And what comes along is World War I and World War II. And a lot of these technologies and knowledge in ancient schools were collected not only from the Nazi Party, but from everybody else around the world. It was a free for all going for King Tut's tomb, if you will. And that's where we are right now. But the technology kind of came together and tied itself together during World War II. And a lot of brilliant scientists were absorbed into the Nazi Party, whipped into shape, and forced into making different types of wonder weapons and exploring that technology. And I think a lot of that culminated with the bell, Dyke Lock. And it was such... Joseph, if you will, what was the classification that they gave Dyke Lock? What was that? They They gave that like supreme treatment.
Well, yeah, DiGlocca was a it was a device that the Germans classified. There's a document I reproduce in Roswell and the Reich. You can find it also in Igor Vitkovsky's book, The Truth About the Wunderwaffe, which is a book I urge people, if you're interested in this sort of thing, spend the money and get the book and read it. It's truly an eye-opener. But in this document, the project that the Bell ultimately is tied to was described as Kriegsentscheidend. All right, and in German that means decisive for the war or war decisive. Now, this is a classification that in Vitkovsky's argumentation wasn't given to the atomic bomb. Now, there are some people that say, well, that was the atomic bomb, and I'm with Vitkovsky on this one for a number of reasons. But this would mean, if you accept his argument, this would mean that they're looking at something much more sophisticated than mere atomic bombs. And the reason I think that Vitkovsky is onto something is back in the 1980s, a British journalist by the name of Tom Augustin wrote a book about the first book really to appear after the war, and this shows you something right there about the Kammler stop and the research that the SS was doing under General Kammler. And he pointed out in his book that the British had found out that besides rockets and lasers and poison gas and nerve agents and atomic bombs, that the Germans were working in an area of physics that was so monstrous on a daily basis. Well, in context, that means there's something deeper and something with much more potential than mere atomic bombs. So in other words, you have it really from two different sources that really don't even refer to each other.
And it wasn't necessarily a weapon, which is a magnitude scarier.
Right, exactly. I tell people in my opinion, what the Bell represented was it was a gateway technology that they were experimenting with. And it was a gateway technology that they were trying to produce a technology by which they could manipulate the zero-point energy, the fabric of space-time, the ether, whatever you want to call it. And they were doing this for three purposes. Because if you have that kind of technology, first of all, you're dealing with unified field physics. You're dealing with a technology that with certain minor modifications, so to speak, you could use for three different purposes. The first was they were looking for a technology of so-called free energy. I don't like the expression free energy, but that's what they were looking for. The second thing they were looking for was if you've got the ability to manipulate the fabric of space-time or to tap into the zero-point energy, you've not only got an inexhaustible energy source, then you also have the potential for field propulsion, for anti-gravity. So they're looking for totally radical, out-of-the-box technologies. The third thing, obviously, is if you can manipulate those kinds of energies, then you'd have a weaponization potential that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So I think the Bell really represents a prototype to see if they can test whether or not there is some sort of coupling mechanism between nuclear physics and gravity and electromagnetism and so on. And that ultimately I think is what the Bell is.
Where does the idea come from?
Well, it comes from a multitude of places. I think Krohn is important to this story with his paper that, you know, we're taking tensor calculus out of the physics of stars and planets, and we're bringing it right down here to the laboratory bench, and we're going to be able to use this to design electrical machinery of any sort that we imagine. The other thing that I think is very crucial to this story is that it's Dr. Walter Gerlach, who is the head not only of Nazi Germany's atom bomb project, but he's also the head of the Bell project. Now, here's the problem. Dr. Gerlach was a specialist in things like spin polarization, magnetism, and gravitational physics. This is the wrong kind of scientist to put in charge of developing an atomic bomb project, but it's exactly the right kind of scientist to put into the head of a project that's investigating those three types of things, which is what you see with the Bell. So Gerlach is crucial because he's the one that's going to be thinking in terms of trying to build, for all intents and purposes, an analog of the sun to see if there's a way that they can use that and manipulate gravitational effects by doing it to manipulate time dilation effects, all of relativity, through slowing down or speeding up radioactive decay rates and so on and so forth. So in other words, this is a huge project. This is a, in my opinion, the Bell is really kind of the long-term result of his little newspaper article back in the 20s in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung about transmutation and alchemy, and all this
right.
good stuff, right?
Well, and it's so, it's such a modern, it's something that physicists today talk about. But we're talking about 1935, 1940,
right.
And it's so advanced and so out of the box. And I have to, you know, where does this come from? And I'm not one to stretch and say, you know, was this channeled? Did this come from somewhere else? Was there somebody else much smarter than us cluing them in? And I'm thinking outside of the box here, but it just seems like such a crazy crazy idea that is just miles ahead. I don't even understand how they could get funded, because how are you going to go and present that to somebody and the ideas of it? Because it's complete science fiction.
Well, I think you have to look at it from the standpoint of these scientists at the time. If you're looking at the papers and everything, and you're coming to the conclusion, yeah, there's some sort of coupling mechanism here, then what you're going to try and do is you're going to try and build, quite literally, an analog of the sun, which is what I think they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you have to go to crashed flying saucers or any of that. You just have to kind of reverse engineer the physics papers and the kind of correspondence that they're having with each other and things of this sort. It is clear to me that the Bell Project was such a closely held secret by the Nazis that they kept that technology to themselves after the war. I think they transferred it to Argentina and continued work on various aspects of it down there.
Let's get to that in a second, because that's an interesting part of the story. How did it operate? Now we know about its general size, but I know there was some counter rotating mercury and so forth. So
it's the details of the story that intrigued me. The details are sufficient enough that you can actually kind of reverse engineer what they're thinking. The Bell is about 15 feet tall, about 12 feet wide. It's made either out of a ceramic or a ceramic type metal. Inside of the device, you have two metal drums, hollow drums, cylinders, that are mechanically rotated to tremendous speeds into around a central axis. The drums themselves and the central axis are electrically polarized. And you're dealing with two, in my opinion, you're dealing with two different types of electrical potentials, AC and DC. And in the center of these spinning drums, they put, supposedly, according to the story that Witkowski researched, they put a substance called Serum 525, which was very heavy, liquid, gooey, kind of maroon, cherry red color that, from the description, he thinks was mercury, and I tend to think that that's probably the case, because mercury is a good plasma-inducing substance under tremendous electrical stress. And I also happen to think it may have contained an isomer of thorium, thorium-229 isomer, and I lay out that case in the Philosopher's Stone. So let's look at what we have. We've got a plasma-inducing material that's radioactive. It has a certain specific radioactive decay rate. We have two electrical potentials. We've got an electrically polarized device. And they're spinning this up, and what that will do is that will cohere the plane of rotation of the molecules of this substance. And after this is accomplished, they probably, in my opinion, electrically rotated it as well. Then they zap it, they pulse it, with enormous amounts of direct current voltage. They literally set off lightning between the spinning drums and the central core. And this is going to produce a plasma state. Now, why are they doing all of this? Well, if you look at the sun, what's the sun? It's a great big, huge plasma in rotation. And the sun, the plasma rotates around the axis of the sun at different velocities. The further north or south you go, it's slower angular velocity, and the center is higher, and so on. So you've got a differential rotation in the plasma, and that's going to induce a phenomenon that the physicists call torsion. And then you have to remember that all of this is occurring in the sun under immense, immense electromagnetic stress.
So torsion, torsion being corkscrew?
Yeah, think of torsion. What torsion does to the fabric of space-time is if you can empty a soda, an aluminum soda can, and then wring it in both hands.
Twist
it. Like a dish rag. Twist it. Yeah, wring it like a dish rag. And the can represents the fabric of space-time. So you're introducing a huge twist and crumpling, and the edges of the can draw closer together. So in other words, you're inducing a huge amount of stress in the local physical medium is what you're doing. So there you have it. You're playing around with gravity. Pace Einstein, when you're playing around with gravity, you're playing around with time. So why do you use this highly radioactive substance to induce the plasma? Well, the other reason is it would be the perfect way, knowing the decay rate, to measure any time dilation that you might be producing as a result of using this machine. Now, when the machine was first tested, when it was first turned on, the field effects from this thing were so deadly that it killed, in Vitkovsky's research, it killed seven of the scientists involved. They later tested this device, and the story goes that plants exposed to the field would decay in a matter of hours, mere hours, into a kind of liquid gray goo.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you're getting, and they would do this without putrefaction, incidentally. So in other words, whatever this thing is doing, whatever the field effects of this thing are, they're tremendous. The final thing about this story is that, and Vitkovsky's come under a lot of criticism from a certain group of critics out there that think the Bell was nothing but an isotope enrichment centrifuge for their atomic bomb project. Well, the description of the device, it's much more sophisticated than just an isotope centrifuge. I think that's a plausible interpretation of some of the data set, but not all of it.
Well, yeah, they were certainly advanced in the centrifuge technology.
Oh, sure,
and all of that was exported out after the war too as well.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely. And that would be a technology that would have given them the experience of extremely high rotation that you would have had to have in this device. But
and they wouldn't have built just one.
Right. Yeah, that's the other problem. But the other interesting thing about the Bell story is that it apparently was tested outside at night. And there were survivors of the local concentration camp, the Gross-Rosen camp, that reported seeing barrel-like, in other words, Bell-like devices glowing and hovering over the tree line at night. So in other words, this thing apparently did create field effects strong enough that allowed it to levitate. But that's all it did. In other words, you're not dealing with a UFO that's darting around the skies and performing all these maneuvers.
There was nobody ever inside of the Bell.
No, well, heavens no.
You would die. You'd
be deader than a doornail.
You would be deader than a doornail. And the right. scientists that were there with their clipboards during the testing, obviously, right. they died, so there wasn't a seat inside of this. So we can take the flying saucer element out of it. I totally agree
right.
with you there.
Right.
But again, was the future idea for this were maybe mini bells, you know, a small type of energy sources? Is that where you're going?
Well, no. I think really what happens here is that they realize that they've discovered their field propulsion technology. They've made that breakthrough, you know, but it's not a technology that at that point that they can use as any practical weapon. It's certainly promising, and it's certainly something that they would have wanted to explore. But obviously the first thing you're going to do is you're going to try and figure out, well, how do we minimize these field effects and allow this thing to be piloted by humans?
Yeah, not kill everybody.
And not kill everybody. So, you know, that's the first thing. The other problem here is that the place or facility where this device was built and tested was in a little town in Lower Silesia, which was German at the time. It's Polish now, but the town was called Ludwigshafen. And the Germans built an entire electrical plant, an electrical power plant, right there to power this device. And the reason I say that almost insistently is that building an electrical power plant in an out-of-the-way little village that's an abandoned mining town, really, is far beyond any electrical power requirements that you would need. So why do you build a power plant there?
A good one.
Well,
yeah,
it's a good one.
Yes.
So this is my clue as to why I say that the amounts of electricity that they're using are not just alternating current, they're direct current. Because direct current, if you recall, steps down rather quickly from the power source to the load end. In other words, you know, we would not have electrification today if we were reliant solely upon direct current electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Alternating current made that possible.
Mm-hmm.
But you would build an electrical power plant if you were required, if you had the requirement of massive amounts of voltage, direct current voltage, that could not be supplied by the capacitor or battery technology of the period. So you'd want to build it as close to your source or to your load end, meaning the bell, as possible. Now that's the clue that the Germans were not building secret flying saucer bases in Antarctica, because if their technology required that amount of direct current electricity, you're not going to be able to build and supply an electrical power plant in Antarctica to continue your research. that's why I don't buy into that whole story either.
Are you reading Twitter? Are you reading Twitter?
No, I know. Okay, I'm sitting here in my office with the light on and my iced tea and smoking my cigarette. So I'm not watching
because
anything.
The questions are coming in just as you're answering them. It's pretty funny. They're immediately jumping to Antarctica. And you cut everybody off the knees. That was really funny. I'm watching the time.
Well, I didn't mean to cut people off the
knees. No, it was great. It's great.
You know, I'm just trying to outline my process of reasoning. And I'm, you know, I'm giving everybody the Cliff Notes version because this is such a huge story. I've written about 5-6 books on the subject of the bell in one way or another because the detailed steps of the argument, you know, the devil's in the details, folks. And it's a very complex story, and once you see it laid out with all the details, I think it will make sense. But I'm just trying to give you the highlights of the main argument here.
Can we scratch a few things off the list then?
Okay.
Okay. Time travel device?
No. Now, that said, I said earlier that they use the radioactive substance to measure any time dilation effects, because if you're dealing with extreme torsion shear, as I think may have been the case with this device, then it will produce minute fluctuations in the radioactive decay rates. So time travel in that sense, yes, but time portals and all of this stuff, no.
Okay, hold on. Time travel device, Keksberg. Can we scratch that off the list?
Oh, on the contrary. In Reich of the Black Sun, and in fact in Giza Death Star Deployed, I pointed out the resemblance of the bell story to the Keksberg acorn on a number of data points. They're about the same size. They're approximately the same shape. And the most interesting thing about the Kecksburg story is Stan Gordon, the gentleman that did all that fantastic research about the story, interviewed a fellow, I think it was on his DVD documentary, a fellow by the name of Myron, that worked for a construction company in Dayton, Ohio, that one day got a call from Wright-Patterson Air Base for an order of about 4,000 ceramic bricks. So up he goes with his truck with the 4,000 ceramic bricks. He's told to take them to a certain hangar, and he goes into this hangar to deliver his bricks, and he sees a silk screen with the shadow of an acorn or bell-like thing behind this silk screen. And to me, that's one of the most significant connecting details, because in Witkowski's research, the bell was housed, when it was tested underground, it was housed in a chamber that was lined with, guess what?
Ceramic bricks, right.
So I think there is some connection between the Kecksburg acorn and the bell. I just think there's too many little detailed data points that connect the two.
Well, and then let's keep moving forward with this line of thought here. So we have German scientists that are double E's, electrical engineers, nuclear physicists. We have the DeBell project. It disappears. We don't know. Paperclip comes into play. These guys come over. They flood into NASA. They flood into GE, as we were just talking about. And then Argentina. Does this technology? Do you think that we applied any of it? I want to get to the Philadelphia experiment too, as well. Did any of this flood into propulsion systems here in the United States?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think definitely it did. You may or may not be familiar with a fellow by the name of Mark McCandlish that's done a lot of research on the so-called alien reproduction vehicle. And he's approached the whole thing from the correct point of view, in my opinion, and that is he's attempted to reverse engineer the physics of the thing that was described to him. And if you look at his description of this craft, it's clearly a human engineered craft, but many of the concepts that were employed in it are very, very similar to the bell. You have huge amounts of capacitors, which imply a vast amount of direct current voltage. You have a plasma inducing substance in the central core. You've got electromagnetic rotation and so on and so forth. So there's definitely some data points connecting to it, and that tells me that, yeah, somewhere along the line we picked up on this idea. And another fellow to look at would be Tim Ventura, that used to run the site Anti-Gravity, AmericanAntiGravity.com. He interviewed an engineer a couple of times on his site that worked for a major American contractor that also told him that he was trying to do proof of concept experiments with a bell-like device, taking cues from Witkowski's research. I was contacted about 4 years ago by a physicist, I don't want to mention his name, that told me that he wanted to test a similar, do similar proof of concept tests, and he told me that he thought I was right about the use of two electrical potentials. So yeah, I think definitely that somewhere along the line we started investigating similar things.
And why didn't Argentina, or maybe they have, with everything that's gone, why haven't they invaded the United States?
Well, that's because the answer is very simple. Because Argentina never really had direct control of the project that was going on down there. I think this, you know, Argentina was the convenient host country, but when that project was exposed inadvertently, I think by Juan Perón, the German scientist involved with it, heading it up, acted such the fool. I mean, I recount all this in the Nazi International. He did such foolish things that the Argentinian physicists that were investigating it and reporting on it to Perón just basically came out and said, "Well, this guy's incompetent. He's a fraud." I think what really happened was that this scientist was told, you know, you're going to sabotage your own project because we're going to move it. And that's really what I think happened.
Well, but there was a pile, there was $1 billion that floated through there too as well.
Oh, yeah.
And that doesn't just disappear. So the knowledge, the technology and the money and the infrastructure, it doesn't disappear. What happened?
Well, the infrastructure itself that was built, the laboratories that were built for this fellow by the Perón government are still, you can still go down to that area of Argentina and see the remains. The scientist himself was placed under house arrest by Juan Perón and basically could not leave Buenos Aires. The United States Air Force interviewed this scientist, curiously enough, after our first hydrogen bomb tests. I recount all that in another book of mine. But the actual project itself, after it gets shut down in Argentina, nobody, and you know, this is a good question. I've been asking myself the same thing, and I've been trying to find out, well, where did it go? You know,
right,
what happened to it after that? And nobody really knows. It went somewhere.
Yeah. Well, in talking to Peter Lavenda about this too as well, he says the exact same thing that you do, that technology definitely, without a doubt, 100% was down in Argentina. What was the name of that island that it was?
It was on Huemo Island.
Yeah.
Near a little city in southwestern Argentina called San Carlos de Bariloche. Which is real close to the foothills of the Andes Mountains, you know, over the border to Chile. So it's about 900 miles southwest of Buenos Aires.
Yeah, you know what? Can you hang on for another 10 minutes?
Sure.
Are you good? Are you good?
Yeah, I'm good, yeah.
Okay, fire up another heater. Let's just do this. This is Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We are talking with Joseph P. Farrell. And let's just stretch. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Let's just stretch this out a little bit. I wanted, you had mentioned the Philadelphia experiment.
Right.
And so I'm going to let you run with this. I'm on the fence. Okay.
Okay.
I'm on the fence. I can go either way. So I want you to tip me in one direction.
Well, I don't know that I can tip you in 10 minutes.
Okay. We'll take 15.
I definitely think that the United States Navy did something. I covered the Philadelphia experiment very carefully in my book, Secrets of the Unified Field. And I definitely think they did something. I think what is probable was that they were aiming for radar invisibility. And what they ended up with may have been optical invisibility. And I put at the very bottom of the list of probabilities remotely possible, and I stress remotely possible, all the stories about teleportation between Philadelphia and Norfolk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my reconstruction of the story, I don't believe that the experiment actually took place in Philadelphia. I think it took place at sea during convoy duty, and I lay out my arguments for that in the book. But I think probably this was an experiment that ran away from them, that they were shocked at what happened. Now, I do think something did happen because of the clever way that the experiment may have been hidden in the post-war period. There were some researchers that appeared on Coast to Coast AM back, I think, in 2002 or 3, somewhere in there. And they outlined their research, and I was so impressed I sent away for their little booklet. And then these people just disappeared. You know, I tried to get a hold of them after that and get a hold of the book and everything. And I talked gave a talk at the 2009 Laughlin UFO conference, and they showed up and introduced themselves, which I was, you know, just glad to see that they were still around. But in their research, they discovered the fact that the records for parts of the USS Eldridge and parts of the Philadelphia experiment, the reason people weren't finding them was, number one, they were looking for the wrong kind of records, and number two, some of the records had disappeared into the Coast Guard.
What?
Yeah. And I thought, well, that's just, you know, that's a perfect place to hide.
Yeah, hide in plain sight right there.
Hide it in plain sight. You know, take it away from the Navy and give it to the
Coast Guard. They'll never suspect the Coast Guard.
No, of course not. You know, I thought, you know, when I read that little portion of their research, you know, I did the palm slap on the forehead thing, you know.
Well, I'm right there. Yes, I'm right there. Of course. I didn't expect that. Was pretty good. Yeah, that's good.
But the other thing here is the physics part. And for me, this is always the crucial point. There were some American engineers with the last name of Daum, D-A-U-M, and Corum, C-O-R-R-U-M. That did an interesting paper. I have it somewhere, and I don't even remember the name of it right off the top of my head, where they were talking about trying to kind of reverse engineer the physics of this thing. And they did little simple proof of concept experiments. Allende talks about the sea turning green and kind of foaming around the outline of the ship that he saw. Well, they did a little experiment. They made a kind of a salt water mixture and charged up a metal thing, and sure enough, the water bubbled away from the object. It just moved away, created kind of a silhouette.
So I don't mean to cut you off, but I want to get this out before we. This was not a giant degaussing experiment.
No,
it wasn't degaussing at all, which has been some of the of the ideas thrown forth out there. So we can take degaussing off of the table, which would have killed everybody anyway, in my opinion, instant. Yeah. Those kind of voltages. Okay, so it wasn't a degaussing experiment. Okay.
But in their paper, the other thing they point out is they point out certain papers German exilee scientist by the name of Arnold Sommerfeld, who was proposing the idea that, and to tell people who Sommerfeld is, he was a close friend of Albert Einstein. So in other words, this guy is not a fly-by-night. He was proposing ideas to increase the incidence of refraction and make the incidence of refraction equal to ones, which would basically give you radar and potentially optical invisibility. And he was doing this in papers and correspondences. So in other words, again, if you look at the papers and the ideas that are being floated around in the community at the time, it makes sense. You're able to point to a track record of where people are saying exactly what the experiment would do. And would the United States be interested in turning its ships radar invisible with an upcoming invasion of Europe, or even optically invisible? Well, yeah, you betcha. Yeah. Of course they would.
With all the U-boats running around and everything else?
Yeah, there's that little problem, too.
Yeah, exactly. and the optical side of it I find really interesting, too, as well. But how can they both do the same thing? I don't know how to ask the question correctly. It's one thing to be invisible to radar. I get that too as well. But to be optically invisible, are we, is it the same technology doing the both at the same time?
It could be. You could do that.
Well, we're talking about two different things. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand fully what you're saying. It could do that possibly, but I think, personally, optical invisibility is a technology that's really only now
being
publicly talked about as a feasible thing, and they're showing you certain technologies that actually accomplish this. But again, you know, that said, I'm always suspicious about all of the leaks and things that we see now of things coming online. I think they've been around a lot longer in the Black Projects world. And again, with the Philadelphia experiment, it's just like the bell. You have an experiment that apparently ran away from them and produced effects that they weren't anticipating. And what are you going to do in such a circumstance? Well, you're going to cover it up because you've lost some of your human crew. And the next thing you're going to do is find out, well, what went wrong and how do we fix it? And so you're going to take it deeply, deeply black. And I think that's probably what happened.
Well, what about the time travel aspect of it and the ship actually moving from Philadelphia to Norfolk? But you're saying it was tested out to sea.
Out at sea. I think there's a very, very low possibility of that. And the reason I say low is, again, that you read this paper of the Corums and Daum on the Philadelphia experiment. And they will come right out and tell you that teleportation by standard models of physics, you know, wormholes and all of that. Well, a wormhole, as I've said to many people many times, a wormhole is really a billion times tinier than tiny.
Yeah.
It requires just a gimungous amount of energy to open up one of those things. But if you're dealing with models of physics that are not the standard model, if you're dealing with things like torsion and so on, torsion might be able to do that, and that's what they say in their paper. But they present it with so many ifs and ands and buts and howevers, you know, that I tend to discount that idea.
Okay, well then I have to go here. Al Bielek. Al Bielek.
Well, if you read the preface to Secrets of the Unified Field, I'm probably less than gentlemanly in what I think of that whole Montauk, you know, split personality time travel theory. I just don't go there. It's not part of my thinking.
It's good reading.
Yeah, it's a wonderful novel. You know,
it's real
books.
Good.
You know.
Well, I mean, Al, when there's been more than one evening where I have put on the 6 hour Al deathbed confession video, right, and just listen to him read and tell his story, and I got to tell you, it causes good dreams.
Yeah.
You know, you can fall asleep to that, and it's just a really good story. I want to believe Al. He's like a cute, huggable guy, you know. Yeah. God rest his soul, but it's a little bit too much for me to bite off. Like I said when it comes to the Philadelphia experiment, something happened. There was some research going on there. There was some high technology in play.
Yeah.
I think I'm with you. I think some stuff got leaked out and some fantasy got involved with it.
And that's always what you do. If something like that leaks out, then you have to spin it into the fantastic direction. You have to obfuscate and create confusion in the data set. And that's exactly the pattern you see with.
And then you have drugs and mind control and some disinfo thrown in for good measure.
Sure.
And there you go. Okay. Now, before I let you go, you have to comment on this because this blasted by from a half a dozen people. What do you mean the Admiral Byrd story is false?
Oh, I didn't say anything about the Admiral Byrd story being false.
Well, no. You know what.
I know exactly what. What I'm talking about, no, the high jump expedition definitely occurred, and he definitely said those things in the San Mercurio, in El Mercurio in Santiago de Chile, that newspaper that reported his remarks. He definitely said those things. That expedition definitely occurred. Something definitely happened down there that made him tuck his tail between his legs and pull out of there months before he was scheduled to do so. Something made his diaries be classified. But what I'm objecting to is to the story that the Nazis set up a secret base in Antarctica where they continued their flying saucer research, and to the attempt to couple that to the high jump story. That's what I'm objecting to, because again, all the indicators to me are that the technology involved in these field propulsion experiments that the Nazis were doing with the belt required too much electricity. You had to have an electrical power plant close by to provide all of the direct current electricity that this thing required to make it work. And you just simply wouldn't have had that in Antarctica.
What happened there? Yeah, what happened? What made Bird make those comments? You know, flying from pole to pole, and we've got some issues we got to work out here, and certainly a lot of men died. You know, but what was it that he ran into?
Well, I do think it's possible that he ran into something Nazi, because, you know, you have to. This is why looking at the details of the arguments in my book are very important, because I do think it's not only possible but likely that the Germans had some sort of base in Antarctica. But, you know, a base is one thing; a research facility is quite another. But if that were the case, and this was potentially being threatened by Admiral Byrd, then maybe they might have taken some sort of action if they had the resources to do so. So I don't rule out that possibility. I'm just saying UFO secret flying saucer research base with laser beams and rail guns and everything else, that's where I draw the line. I just don't see that.
I got to thank you for coming on the show, and really quick.
Well, thank you for having me, Jim.
It was great, and I can't wait to get you back on. Really quick, what are you doing now? Are you going to do any speaking?
I have a conference I'm supposed to go to and speak at somewhere in the Los Angeles area in January. I don't know exactly where, because I'm waiting for the details, and I might have another conference to be speaking at possibly next June in Colorado. I don't know the details of that yet, but that's about it.
Well, when you come out here to LA, you've got to hang out with us.
And okay.
Absolutely. Come on. Come directly into the studio. And all of your books, is it everything through Giza Death Star, the website or Amazon?
Yeah. My website, the web store on my website has all of my books. They do order from Amazon, but if you order off my website, Amazon gives me a few pennies extra on my royalties.
do you sign books?
I do sign books if I'm at conferences and people, you know, if they bring their copies and want me to sign them, sure, I'll sign them. But I don't have any way of doing that here directly. The books come directly from Amazon. I just get a little extra percentage for advertising.
I get you. I got to thank you for coming on. I just had an extraordinary evening. And again, we just scratched the surface. I know that we danced a little bit on so many different subjects, but there's so much to deal with when it comes to yourself. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jimmy, for having me. Bye-bye.
You got it. Joseph P. Farrell, everybody, thank you so much. And with that, let's take a quick break. Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, at J Church Radio. That's what you want to do. That's Twitter, hashtag DM Radio Net. I'm going to take a couple minutes, and I'll be back right after this. Do not touch that mouse. I'll be right back. Hey, let's take some phone calls. I'll take two. We got enough time. 323-825-5045. I'll be back right after this. Stay with us.
Despite popular opinion, reading a book will not make you smarter.
But listening to Jimmy Church will, on the Dark Matter Radio Network.
He's always giving it to you straight.
JimmyChurchRadio.com.
On the Dark Matter Radio Network.
Here's Tom, Ricky, Gabby, and you're listening to JimmyChurchRadio.com.
This is KJCR at JimmyChurchRadio.com.
On the Dark Matter Radio Network.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Fade to Black, only on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Joseph P. Farrell. Man, oh, man. I've got enough time for one, maybe two phone calls. 323-825-5045. Come on, Fader Nuss. Let's just ride this one out. I got to know what you guys just thought of that. That was absolutely amazing. I was going to do the Hollow Earth. I just saw that pop up. You know what? That's not really what he's about. There's a lot of things when it comes to Joseph Farrell that he just doesn't, he doesn't go there. He doesn't go there with the vril. He doesn't go there when it comes to time travel. He doesn't go there with the bell, that it was some kind of time travel device. There's a lot of play. He just doesn't go there. And he's about research. And that's it when it comes to Joseph Farrell. So, yeah, I was going to go there. I was thinking about it, but... Hi, you're live on Fade to Black. Who's calling?
This is the Bear from Santa Clara.
Hey, Bear, the bright spot in my day. Hey, you know what? You want me to bring Steve in, too?
Oh, it's fine.
Yeah, let's bring in Steve. Let's do that. Okay. It's late on the East Coast. Hey, Steve, you're on with Bear.
What's going on,
hey, Steve?
Bear, what's going on, brother?
What did you guys think of that? That was a pretty amazing evening, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, Bear first.
Definitely cool.
Bear first. Bear, what did you think?
I thought it was pretty cool. A couple things kind of crossed my mind about the Philadelphia thing. I was wondering if maybe they weren't trying to play with a plasma field around that thing, or maybe even some ultrasonics to kind of, cause a, water wave to come out of it, kind of like when you have like one of those little ultrasonic misters.
Yes.
Okay. And also, one thing too about capacitors that I wanted to kind of bring up is, they're real good about, blocking DC, but letting AC going through them too. So something you might not have known about. But
Bear, you have a scientific background. What did you think? That's when it comes to Joseph. He's all about the science, And what did you think about the way he presented that side of it?
I think for somebody who, who's trying to make something very complex simple, I think he did an extremely good job.
How about you, Steve? I'll throw that at you.
Well, he done an awesome job. That's what he does. He researches. You said at the beginning of the show, the man's the best, one of the best researchers in the business.
And he presents it. I've been such a fan of his for so long, and I just try to absorb and listen and read everything that he's ever put out, because he explains it in such a way that a doofus like myself, I understand it, and I can get through a conversation. He's obviously, mountains smarter than myself, but he's able to allow me to stay part in the conversation. And did it translate? Did it come back that way to you guys?
Yes. I think he did a pretty good job of making something very complex seem as simple as possible, to where, people can kind of wrap their minds around it a little bit.
You too, Steve, a simple farm boy from the South like yourself, could you get through it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I'm dumber than a box of rocks. And for me,
I'm dumber than a bear.
Half of it.
He's got to fling some poop around,
Yeah, right. Hey, Steve, I did see your picture of the 27-pound turkey. How many people did you feed with that?
There was 19 or 20 of them that come to the house.
Wow. Did you run out of turkey? Was that enough, or did you have two?
No, I fixed the big turkey and then I fixed a big ham, and then, everybody brings something.
Yeah.
There's always some leftovers, usually.
Hey, Bear, I didn't ask you. How was your Thanksgiving?
Oh, it was okay. Just a normal thing. Just kind of kicked back and enjoyed it as much as possible. And had the grandkids and everything, and it was fun.
Thanksgiving is such an important part of the, and I haven't really talked to everybody too much about their Thanksgiving. And now we're heading into Christmas, man. And also, I want to tell you real quick, you're both on the air with us now, and we're still live. Next week is our anniversary week. Can you believe it? And
I just had my 38th a couple weeks back.
No, I'm talking about the anniversary for this show.
For the show.
Well, I was talking about me and my wife.
So, yeah, next week, if you can only imagine, you know, this week we have Joseph Farrell, tomorrow Robert Morningstar, and then Laird Scranton with us on Wednesday, then Fader Night. And wait till you see what we've got lined up for next week for the anniversary week. It's going to freak you guys out. I can't believe it. It's been 1 year.
Man, time goes by so fast.
I know. It's crazy. All right, guys. Hey, so tomorrow night, I'll see you guys right here, Robert Morningstar. And it's going to be awesome. Thank you guys for calling in.
Yeah, and I'd like to say to everybody, be safe, be well, and hi to all the Fader Nuts out there, and I'll catch you offline.
Thank you, Bear.
Signing off.
Thank you, Bear. Bear, hey, Steve, Bear is the bright light in our day, isn't he?
That's right.
He's absolutely amazing. So, again, really quick, Joseph Farrell, did he do to you what he did to me? Doesn't he just kind of make you think? You know,
well,
just,
it makes you think. I mean, you know, he brought up a lot of good subjects that a lot of people don't talk about when it comes to World War II. And, you know, with, you know, Germany was a hell of a lot further along and was capable of the nuclear, nuclear bombs. And everybody tried to blow it off like, you know, they were dumb and they really weren't.
Oh, no.
You know, people want to say, well, you know, why did Germany lose the war? You know, Germany didn't lose the war because of the people. You know, Hitler made some bad decisions, you know, and he didn't listen to his generals, and it cost him.
You know, they just eventually just ran out of gas and oil and everything. They just ran out of gas. Oh, hey, tomorrow night, Robert Morningstar, man. I'm really looking forward to it, and I'll talk to you tomorrow night. Thank you so much, Steve.
Hey, thanks for the time, Jimmy. Have a good night, brother.
You too, brother. All right, that brings us to the end of another day here on Fade to Black. Thank you so much. What have we got going here? All right, I'm clicking. We are moving forward. Special thanks to Joseph P. Farrell. Coming up next, the unexplained and expanded perspectives. Special thanks to Keith Rowland and Art Bell, Fade to Black's executive producers, Rita Kamarian. Shows produced by Hilton J. Palm, Mark D. Kovar. Thanks to LJ3, Renee, and Jonas. Announcers are Steve Harder, Gene Vito, and Mark D. Kovar. Fady by Dale. Webmaster is Method. Music is this guy right here, Doug Aldrich. Our intro is by Spaceboy, spaceboy.com. Fade to Black is produced by KJCR for the Dark Matter Radio Network. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Tomorrow night, Robert Morningstar right here. Everybody, be safe. See ya.